True or false?
I don't watch Raw. You're not missing much. It's all good. Nobody does.
True. Yikes.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the streak.
I like fighting a woman.
What is with this company's obsession with ninjas?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
This is episode 678 of the Solo Monster Sounds Of here for Sunday, November 15, 2020. Brought to you by our good friends at Audible. You can get one free audiobook of your choosing when you use our Sound Off link, audibletrial.com/Solo Monster. Been a proud sponsor of the podcast now for a long time. So show our friends at Audible some love and get yourself one free audiobook. You guys blew me away. On Thursday night, we were live on YouTube, big 13-year anniversary celebration, answering your questions for almost 3 hours. I answered almost 90 questions, and that only scratches the surface of all the questions that I have still sitting in my inbox, so bear with me. But I answered nearly 90 of your questions about pretty much everything, and I want to thank everybody who made that stream so much fun, such a huge success. We're definitely going to do more of them in the future. In fact, I even floated the idea of maybe doing a little something on New Year's Eve, going live on YouTube New Year's Eve for more Q&A. As we get rid of this year, we ring in the new year, 2021. So if that's something you think you guys might be interested in, let me know. And I might have to start putting some plans in place for a New Year's Eve stream. Get together on YouTube as well. But again, thank you for everybody who made that stream such a huge success. And if you missed it, please go back and check it out. You may have sent a question into me in recent weeks that potentially was answered on there. So definitely go back, check that out, and leave comments in the comment section on the video. If you want to support the podcast, you can always do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. $30 or more for a shout-out, for a podcast, for whatever else it may be. You guys know the drill. I want to say thank you to Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart, Raymond the Mountie Medina, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Stephen Handyman Halistick, Stephen Mad Dog Martinez, and I gotta give a shout out to Guitar Hero John Kiernan, who has been working on theme songs for a whole host of independent wrestlers. A few weeks ago, you heard me play a snippet of Chris Dickinson's theme. Take a listen to this. It is from a theme called We Are Change, with lyrics written and performed by Monster Tarver, the former Michael Tarver of The Nexus in WWE.
I've been at war with depression and I would destroy any messages with hope and aggression. We will not conform to your lesson. The movement is bigger than wrestling. We have been chosen to represent. And if you know what is better, to know the vendetta of anyone holding the cheddar, we come in and force your residence. And we're becoming those against a lot of you to burn it down with the fire inside of you. You don't want us to come over and fight with you. If you don't like it, then do what you gotta do. And
that is the theme for The Division, which is a New Jersey-based faction with members from various promotions like Monster Factory Pro Wrestling, Ring of Honor, and others. You can find the full track by searching We Are Change, John Kiernan, on YouTube or any streaming services. Just search the name John Kiernan, K-I-E-R-N-A-N. You could also find more of his wrestling themes on youtube.com/John Kiernan Music. We got more shouts coming up in a little bit, so hang tight, guys, because we got the top story that we have to get into here this week. Zelina Vega. Zelina Vega was backstage at SmackDown on Friday night when she got the news that she was fired. We've all gotten so used to WWE speak when we say so-and-so was released, she was fired. Zelina Vega was fired. And wished well in her future endeavors at 5:46 p.m., likely right after being informed of her quote-unquote release, she tweeted, "I support unionization." 10 minutes later, at 5:56 p.m., WWE tweeted that they had come to terms on her release. And immediately people were up in arms that they fired her because she tweeted her support for unionization. She was not fired for her support of unionization, or at least not that tweet. Who knows what she was telling people behind the scenes, but that is not, it's not a cause and effect situation where, I know it looks that way, where, oh, she put the tweet up and 10 minutes later she was fired. I don't think WWE would be able to get their shit together and act that quickly even if they wanted to. That tweet does not go out unless she already knew that she was being let go. And she was likely let go, and look, we don't know yet for sure, because she isn't talking about it, but the belief is that she was the most vocal of all the talent, maybe aside from Paige, certainly most vocal amongst active talent, about keeping her Twitch account, which WWE wanted her to either just abandon or hand over the control to. She's very active on Twitch. You know, she has said it's good for her mental health. She enjoys it. It's something that's very important to her. She also recently opened an OnlyFans page where she charges up to $1,000 for 10 pictures where fans can choose what cosplay outfits that they want to see her wearing. Of course, that goes with a no nudes policy. I think that goes without saying. Vince McMahon let the roster know over 2 months ago. It was 2 months ago when these reports first came out. I think it was right around August 30th. Right after SummerSlam, around the time of that Payback pay-per-view. Vince McMahon, in the form, I think, of a phone call, initially, let people know what was coming. And then, later that week, a letter went out to inform the roster, I think, that they had a certain deadline. It was like a 30-day deadline to basically abandon any and all relationships that the talent had with third parties, like a Twitch or a Cameo, or I guess OnlyFans probably would be included in that as well. The problem is that it was still very unclear. There were a lot of talent that were kind of talking to different websites without putting their names on it, saying that they were just very confused. It was not properly explained to them exactly what this meant or what services specifically it applied to. So there was a lot of anger. There was a lot of confusion at first. Still is. I'm not sure it was ever really made fully 100% clear. But that was the initial outreach that they made. I think that deadline may have been extended. And then a couple of weeks ago, if you notice, people started to close down their Twitch accounts. So they had plenty of notice that this was coming. This was hardly a surprise. She obviously elected to continue with these third parties, or was a little too vocal about it, and WWE decided to make an example out of her. Because I'm sure that if Randy Orton had a Twitch channel, and we've seen Randy Orton active on Twitch before, so he may well have a Twitch. Randy Orton has been found to game with fans on Twitch before. But I think if it was a Randy Orton, if it was someone like him saying, piss off, I'm still going to go stream, you know, maybe they would suspend him. Maybe they would punish him in some way, fine him, probably fine him, which to Randy Orton is probably be a drop in the bucket. But if you believe, that you're going to get a tweet from WWE telling us that WWE has come to terms on the release of Randall K. Orton, then I have a bridge here in Brooklyn I can sell you. That ain't going to happen. Zelina Vega was low-hanging fruit for them. She was not a major part of the show right now. She was when she was back on Raw earlier this year. It was like the Zelina Vega show. She was managing Andrade. She was managing Austin Theory. She was managing Angel Garza. She had her own little group. She had her own little faction. And she was great in that role. She wasn't an active wrestler. I mean, she could take bumps and interfere and stuff, but it was in that managerial role. That was really where her strength was. And then they split her away from them, and they put her in the ring. And look, maybe that's something that she requested. Maybe she went to management and said, look, I want to wrestle more, or I don't want to do this, I'd like to wrestle. We don't know. I don't know if that was a decision that was just unilaterally made by the company, or if she had told them, look, if you can get me in the ring, I would love to be in the ring more often. That was a mistake. Whoever's decision that was, I think that was a mistake. Her value to them was not in the ring or less in the ring. It was in the role that she had with Andrade. And look what's happened to Andrade since then. Now, I thought he was going in for some kind of elective surgery, so it's possible we haven't seen him on TV because he's still recovering from that. But even before that, what was Andrade doing on TV? Nothing. Nobody was made stronger once they were split. If they're going to be split, you think, all right, Zelina's going to go on to, you know, become bigger than she was, or Andrade now, he's going to go on to bigger things. Neither one of them went on to bigger things. It was a poor decision. And once they split her away from them, she was on the low end of the women's roster all by herself. And that's a lonely place to be right now. If you're not one of the featured women on that roster, Raw or SmackDown, that is a lonely place to be. And you are not considered, clearly, to be an important part of the show. So it was very easy for them to say, you know what, we have to put our foot down and show these people that we are serious. And if you want to work here, you got to play by our rules and obey. And not step out of line. Now, she was back on Twitch Friday night within a few hours of the announcement and her being sent home. She was given her walking papers. She was back on Twitch, and she was very emotional. This did not come off like someone who wanted to be fired, who was trying to be fired without actually quitting, or who asked for her release. She seemed completely caught off guard by what happened. She was shell-shocked by the news. She called it the worst day of her life. Now, think about that statement coming from someone who has talked openly about losing her father in the 9/11 attacks. So yeah, I mean, let's shoot down the idea that she was trying to get fired or anything like that. She said that she is not angry, she's heartbroken, but she did not say anything negative about WWE. She thanked a lot of people who worked there. She thanked Triple H, she thanked Stephanie, she thanked The Rock, she thanked Tommy Dreamer, she thanked Norman Smiley. She said she wanted to work for WWE ever since she was a little girl. Like Sasha Banks. Ever since she was 4 years old, she wanted to work for WWE. It was her dream. She said there's a reason for everything, even if right now it's not exactly clear what that is. But she says she's definitely not done wrestling. And the belief is that she is tied to the same standard 90-day non-compete that most people would be in this situation. So she wouldn't be able to sign anywhere. The earliest we'd be able to see her, you know, on another show wouldn't be until mid-February. I'm not so sure that she won't be back before then. I don't see a lot of people talking about this, but I am not convinced that we will not see her back in WWE even before that non-compete is up. Because look, I don't think they wanted her to leave. I don't think they were just waiting for her to step out of line so that we can get rid of Zelina Vega because she's difficult to deal with or anything like that. I don't think this is what anybody wanted. And I certainly don't think she wanted to leave. That much is clear just based on her reaction and her, you know, being practically in tears on Friday night. And if they get this Twitch thing sorted out, because clearly what they're doing is they're preparing to... Now, WWE already has a channel on Twitch. Definitely not as big of a presence on there as they have on YouTube, for example. Obviously, they want to grow their footprint on Twitch. I don't know the full extent of what their plans may be. There's LinkedIn job postings out there. They're looking to hire more people, like a Twitch manager and people to help come in and really build this thing up. So whatever their idea is, whatever the end game is here, you know, when I talked a few weeks ago about where I think this might be going, I think one of two situations, either they get their own Twitch situation sorted out internally, and then they allow people like AJ Styles and Mia Yim and Cesaro and all these people who were twitching before. Is that the right way to say it? They were all twitching. Maybe they then allow them to go back to doing it on their channels, but they work a system out where now they're getting a cut. Or they just consolidate everything on the official WWE channel. And they work out some weekly schedule where these people will Twitch, but it will be on the WWE official channel and not their own. I don't know exactly what their plans are. But once they work all of that out, and these people, let's say, go back to streaming again, whether it's their channel or the WWE channel, WWE works out their cut that they're going to get. You know, I would not count out the possibility of them possibly working things out and bringing her back before her non-compete, you know, comes to an end. First of all, let me say this. I applaud her. I applaud anyone who has the guts to stand up for themselves and use their voice, even if it may not always be in their best interest to do so. And yes, there are a lot of people who are out of work right now. There are a lot of people out there who are suffering. We're in the middle of a pandemic. A lot of people are hurting. People who don't make the kind of money that I'm sure folks like Zelina Vega maybe are making or were making, either in WWE or just off of her Twitch alone. I'm sure she was doing very nicely. Maybe not as nicely as Paige seems to be doing on Twitch. But Zelina has a nice audience on Twitch, and people are always gifting her subs, and she seems to do very well for herself. But that has nothing to do with the fact that the woman stood up for something that really meant something to her. You know, whether it was the money, whether it was just, you know, something fun that she likes to do that just brings her a lot of joy. Whatever her primary motivation is, she had the guts to do something that nobody else in that company has had the guts to do, aside from Paige, who is not an active part of the roster like Zelina was. The only person to do that so far is Zelina Vega. And she paid the price for it. And I don't expect anybody else there to stand up for her, because they're all worried about their own jobs. They're all worried about their own spots and their own families. Nobody wants to upset the apple cart. Now, where this gets interesting is the unionization comment. I did notice the tweet responding to Zelina from Gabrielle Carteris, the president of the Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, more easily referred to as SAG-AFTRA. They are the labor union representing people in the entertainment industry. She saw Zelina's tweet, and she tweeted back at her, thanking her for standing strong for labor solidarity. I support you, she says. And then she says, please email me, and she provided her email address. By the way, I had no idea before I was today years old this week when I learned that the woman who played Andrea on Beverly Hills 90210 now heads the SAG union. So, the more you know. But I've always wondered, and I know some of you have too, because I've gotten email questions about this, why pro wrestlers either did not join or were not allowed to join SAG. Now, there are exceptions to that. People who have actually acted in feature films, Roddy Piper, and maybe somebody like Terry Funk, I don't know, Jesse Ventura. You know, that's a whole different situation, but just pro wrestlers, WWE stars, why are they not allowed to join SAG? I mean, they're actors, right? They're on-screen performers. It never made a whole lot of sense to me, but it appears that she has now caught their attention. Will anything come from it? Probably not. Probably not. But I'm what I call a realist, leaning more towards pessimist. People talk about this all the time. Oh, here we go. This is where real change happens. And very rarely does real change happen in situations like this. So it's nice that they're taking notice of this, and I hope they look into it. But do I actually think things are going to change all of a sudden? Probably not. But it is interesting to see them acknowledging the situation so publicly for the first time. I can't recall a time where any representative of that union, let alone the president of it, has so publicly reacted to a pro wrestler in a situation like this. Now, we've heard comments, you know, from Andrew Yang. People keep telling me, oh, what about Andrew Yang? What about Andrew Yang? comments that he's made going after Vince McMahon. He said it again this past week. I haven't forgotten. I haven't forgotten about Vince McMahon. It's like he's threatening him. And his issue really is with how WWE classifies its performers as independent contractors and not as employees. And look, AEW and other promotions, they don't classify their talent as employees either. I mean, unless you're EVPs, like Cody Rhodes and Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks, then you're employees. Everybody else, they're independent contractors. Now, of course, the biggest difference between a promotion like WWE and AEW, for example, because AEW in this country is the next biggest thing, so I'll cite them. The biggest difference there is that in a lot of cases, not every case, there are some exclusive deals, but in a lot of cases, they allow people to take outside bookings, you know, even if AEW has to approve them, they allow that. And there are still AEW talents who are wrestling on independent shows, which I actually think, especially in the middle of the pandemic, is stupid. And I would not allow that if I were Tony Khan. I actually think that's a terrible move on their part. But if they're doing that to, you know, bring in some more compensation, that's something I think AEW ought to work out with some of those guys, even if that means paying them a little bit more, because I just think it's incredibly unnecessarily risky if you have people who you're using on television and in the meantime they're going out and doing independent shows and you don't know if the standards at those shows are as stringent. They're probably not, because they can't afford it in terms of COVID testing and all that. I just think it's insane that they even allow that, but they do. And that's one of the big differences and probably the big things that attract some of these people to an AEW more so than WWE. There is a certain level of freedom that you would have there that you would not have working for Vince McMahon. But any change in that classification is going to be felt throughout the industry, not just in WWE. But it has always been ludicrous that WWE has classified talent that way. They should have health care and vacation time and benefits like any other employee in that company has. Talent is the lifeblood of that company. Without the talent, there is no WWE. And Vince McMahon has preyed upon that now for decades. We know this. The money might be better now than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago, but he's made a career out of this. Now, I know Andrew Yang is a fan. He is. He's a wrestling fan. You hear him talk about wrestling, and he has memories of WrestleMania 3 and all this stuff. So I know he's a legitimate fan, and I think his heart is in the right place, but he seems convinced that just because, you know, Joe Biden won, he's going to be the new labor secretary. He may not be. And even if he's not, and he has the ear of the person who is, this wrestling stuff is not going to be a priority when you've got 50 million people out of work in the middle of a raging pandemic. And all of the other issues that, you know, we have to deal with at the moment in this country. Too many to even talk about here. It's crazy. We're living through very crazy times right now. I think their time can be better spent on other things at the moment rather than WWE stars making good money who want to be able to stream on Twitch and do cameo videos for a little more on the side. I think they have more pressing issues to deal with in the government right now. But I don't believe there will ever be a union in pro, all this union talk. I don't believe there will ever be a union in pro wrestling, or at least not one led by some kind of uprising within WWE. It's just not going to happen. And the reason it's not going to happen, the money is too good. I mean, let's just be perfectly honest here. For a lot of the people who work there, not necessarily everybody, and the people on the very bottom, but for a lot of the people who work there, the people who would matter if you wanted their voices in this conversation, because it doesn't matter if you have people on you know, the lower end, like a Zelina Vega, or people even lower in the pecking order than she is. You need people with a name. But the people with names are making good money. They're making a good living for themselves. Great money, even, in some cases. Not even good, great. And as long as they're able to make a good living and they're able to support their family and put money away for their kids' college, you are not going to see this groundswell of support for a union. You'll have people who clap. Oh, yeah, they'll clap like seals for Zelina Vega. Oh, I'm so proud of her. I respect her so much. You know, they'll clap for her when people like Zelina do speak out because they respect them for it, and they would rather it be her and not them speaking out. But they won't do it themselves. Because the dirty little secret is that they're doing pretty well for themselves in most cases. And if that means they can't do Twitch and they can't do this and they can't do that, that they would like, you know, things they would like to do that they think they should be allowed to do because, well, they're independent contractors. They'll let it slide because they have that security blanket that they're just not willing to let go of. And I can't say that I blame them. I can't say that if I were in their shoes, I wouldn't react the exact same way. But once again, nothing will change without strength in numbers. And more than just one person speaking out. I see people like Ryback and Matt Morgan and Mike Kanellis this week tweeting out their support. Ryback has not worked for WWE in 4 years. Matt Morgan has not worked for WWE, I think, in something like 15 years. Mike Kanellis was let go earlier this year. The point is, what's the one thing they all have in common? They no longer work for Vince McMahon. They don't work for WWE anymore. WWE doesn't care what they have to say. They don't care about what they think. It's easier for them to tweet out their thoughts and be honest about things, but WWE doesn't care. Their voices in that conversation doesn't matter. You need rebellion from within. But why rebel when you're making mid six figures or high six figures with a nice house and a nice car? What's to rebel about? Nothing is going to change. When contracts come due next year, 2022, 2023, and they have to sign that piece of paper again. They put the paper in front of them and say, here, 6 months out. We want to renew now. We want you to sign this. That's when we'll know what's really important to them. If people stay or if they choose to leave. You know, when guys use other companies to leverage better deals for themselves, Randy Orton leveraged AEW. He admitted it. He admitted. He thanked Tony Khan. They had that little Twitter spat. He thanked Tony Khan. He leveraged AEW to get himself a better contract. AJ Styles leveraged AEW to get himself a better contract. Do you think they leveraged AEW for a contract that states that they can stream on Twitch? Do you think there's language anywhere in there? And I guess this controversy came about after they had already signed. But even still, do you think that was first and foremost on their mind when they were negotiating a new deal with WWE? Well, I want to make sure this provision is put in there because Twitch is so important to me. Do you think that's what they were leveraging when they had those contracts made up? Or that they can do all of those other things on the side? Of course not. They got more money. That's what they got. That's what it always comes down to. More money. And WWE is swimming in it right now, even without people in the audience. They haven't run a single live event with people in the crowd since March. And they're still making more money than they ever have before. So they can afford to throw money at people if they want to keep them. That's the power and the leverage that they have. By the way, just to piggyback on that, because this was other news that broke this week, they fired Tony Chimmel. He had been with the company for over 30 years. Mostly in recent years, he had been working as a live event ring announcer. He wasn't really doing that on TV anymore, unless Edge came back, and then he would do the Edge, the whole, you know, the rated R superstar. Yeah, that was his shtick. But for the most part, in recent years, he was doing ring announcing at the live events. But he had been there forever. They fired him. And they fired the head of their arena merchandise division, who had been with the company for over 25 years and was very well liked and very well regarded. But there was a note, you know, in the Observer this week that even without house shows and the arena tapings, their merchandise numbers on WWE Shop, what they have found during the pandemic, because they have no live events, right? They can't sell merch at the buildings. Interestingly, what the company found is that their merchandise numbers on the website skyrocketed to make up whatever they may have lost by not being able to run live shows. So all signs point to the company either completely abandoning house shows, except for maybe major shows in big markets like a New York or a Chicago. House shows may be going away, either completely or they are going to severely reduce, which we kind of already had heard about, but severely reducing the number of live events that they run even after the pandemic is over and things kind of get back to normal. Now they make most of their money off their TV contracts. That and Saudi Arabia. That's where they make most of their money. Fox, NBC Universal, and the Saudi Prince. So they got plenty of money to throw around if they really want certain people. They want to hold on to them. They want to sign them. They got plenty of money they can throw around. But it all boils down to money or freedom. What is more important to you? I respect Zelina Vega for standing up for what she believed in, but when she continued to stream, this should not have come as a surprise. They were warned that this could happen, and Vega is not Charlotte Flair. She is not Becky Lynch, or Randy Orton, or Roman Reigns. Because like I said, if it were a Roman Reigns or a Randy Orton streaming, they wouldn't be on the unemployment line right now. I guarantee you that. It's people like her, who they want you to fall in line. And if you don't, you're going to be the first person out on your ass. Question now shifts to her husband and what happens with him, because he can't be happy about any of this. He can't be happy that his wife got fired and she's sitting at home in tears over what happened. But even more so than his wife, because there are plenty of examples of people, couples who were together in WWE, now they're not. One spouse works for one company, one spouse works for the other. We see it now with Miro and Lana. Ironically, she's been going through tables every week ever since. But there's plenty of examples of that, right? I mean, you even got Cedric Alexander, Big Swole. So that in and of itself is not a big deal. But more so than the situation with his wife, we had the tweet this week from WrestleVotes, which has proven to be fairly reliable in the past. And WrestleVotes chimed in and said that recently, Aleister Black requested to be moved back to the NXT brand. You remember that, right? You know NXT, the place that actually knew what the fuck to do with this guy when he was down there. And his request was denied. I don't know why the request was denied. If it was denied because they simply don't have a place for him, I think you can make a place for him. I think that, you could a guy like him would certainly bring more star power to the NXT brand, but I also can understand it because they have a ton of people down at the Performance Center who are not getting television time. Even now with 2 hours on USA every week, there are a lot of people who are on the sidelines just sitting around kind of waiting. And even worse, they don't have the live events on the Florida circuit to go and kind of hone their craft and get exposure in front of at least the local fans in Florida, because they're not running any live events. So all these people are just kind of sitting on the back burner waiting for their turn. I can understand that, because here comes a guy from the main roster taking up a spot. Finn Balor came back to take a spot on the NXT roster. Charlotte for a while went back to NXT and she was taking up a spot, but it was for the betterment of the brand, right? They were bringing star power to the brand. But I can understand the thinking, if that is the thinking on this. Like, look, we just don't have a place for you. We already have X number of people who aren't getting exposure because we just don't have a place for them. But whatever their reasons were, his request supposedly was denied. And there is said to be a lot of friction, a lot of tension on both sides. Aleister Black has absolutely no reason to stay with WWE. Outside of possible financial considerations, he has no reason to stay there at this point. They never knew what to do with him from the moment he was called up. They randomly paired he and Ricochet off as a tag team. Two guys who should have been big single stars. And the first thing they do is they put them together in this makeshift tag team. But you know what ended up happening? They actually started to get over as a team. They were a pretty damn good team. And then what happened? They split them up. When they were getting over, they split them up. But still, I felt like, all right, fine, it's time. Aleister Black should not be in a tag team. Ricochet probably should not be in a tag team either. Let's give these guys a chance to really get over and become big stars on the brand. Aleister Black, I think, always had more potential to be the bigger star. I just love the whole package, the music and the entrance, and his work has always been great. I thought this guy could really be the total package. He can speak, so he can cut promos if you want him to talk. I'm not so sure he should have been talking all that much. I'm not saying just make him the next Undertaker, but that kind of character, that could have been Aleister Black. And the potential for him, I thought, was just unlimited if they handled him the right way on that main roster. But they had this team that was getting over. They split them up like they do with every other fucking team in this company. They broke them up and then they proceeded to do pretty much nothing. They never understood the character. They just did not know what they were doing with this guy. They kept him locked in a room, getting all, you know, pissy at people. You know, Aleister Black, scoff if you want, but I stand by the idea that I pitched, what was it, like a year ago probably? Maybe more than a year ago? Had they taken the time to build him up properly and keep him undefeated for a while, keep him unbeaten for a while, and keep the entrance and keep them, even with the stupid creak that Vince McMahon decided to throw in. He's always got to put his little mark on it, right? He gave the creak when Aleister would pop up from that platform like he was fucking Dracula. Ricochet had the pew pew little Ricochet noise when he always has to put his little stamp on it. Even with that, keep the music, keep the entrance. It's all you had to do. He could have been a great final opponent for The Undertaker this year at Survivor Series, when there was still some, you know, doubt about whether or not Undertaker was he going to retire at WrestleMania? Was he going to have one more match? He shouldn't. Believe me, if you gave me the choice, I would not want to see Undertaker back in the ring. I actually thought the match at WrestleMania, the cinematic match, was the best possible send-off he could have had, because it was the highlight of WrestleMania this year. But when there was some debate still about what are they going to do for Survivor Series, because it's the 30th anniversary of his debut, it's Survivor Series 1990, he's got to be on that show, even if he just comes out and just makes an appearance, but maybe he'll do one last match, and if he does, and if it's not just him against Kane or some other legend, who from the current roster could we see Undertaker in the ring with, you know, for one final match? And I pitched Aleister Black. I said, if you just build this guy up and take your time, he could be that guy. Another dark, brooding character, but a guy who can work and a guy who you can kind of pass the baton to. Again, not to be the next Undertaker, because that's a shitty thing to say. Nobody can ever be the Undertaker. Nobody can ever be the next this or the next that. But he could have been that kind of star. But now I look back and I think back to that idea and it's laughable. Feel free to go ahead and laugh at it. I would do the same. This man is like a totally different person now. I don't even recognize him. I don't even recognize him as being the same person from NXT. It's like two totally different people. And even if their intent was not to do so, this guy has been buried on the main roster. There's that word. I don't use that word very often. You guys know that, but I'm going to use it here. Aleister Black has been buried 6 feet under since being called up from NXT, and it's no wonder he wants to go back. Remember how Michael Cole described him on TV the minute he got called up? And it may have only been one time, and thankfully they stopped doing it. But remember when he debuted, Michael Cole, the word that he used to describe Aleister Black, he called him moody. Like he's on fucking hormones. Moody. Why is Aleister Black so moody? These people are idiots. You know, earlier this year, I don't remember who he was interviewing with, but Aleister Black made a comment. This was back in March, probably right before the world went to hell. And he said, you know, they asked him about his future or whatever, and he, how much longer do you want to be doing this? And at the time, he said that he hopes to have another 5 to 10 years in WWE. I wonder if he feels the same way now as he did when he made that comment. Speaking of The Undertaker, saying all the right things. He's been doing some media. He's really talking about this like this is it. He's done. They really want you to believe that this is the final farewell. But this is the problem that happens when you jerk people around for so long into thinking that this could possibly be the end. I mean, WrestleMania 33, that being the most egregious example, that should have been the send-off for The Undertaker. But nope, he came back again. So you really can't blame fans, I think, for not buying into the idea that this could be the final farewell. Do I believe this is going to be the last time we ever see him in the Undertaker gear make an appearance on TV? No, I don't. But they are gearing up like this is going to be the final farewell. They're inviting all of his old buddies into the show. Savio Vega is going to be making a special appearance for the Undertaker's final farewell, or at least he'll be in attendance. I'm not saying he'll be in the ring with him, but he's going to be in attendance at the Thunderdome for Survivor Series, as will the Godfather. He'll be in attendance at the event. Kane will likely be there as well. Who knows who else? Looks like we're getting a little BSK reunion with Savio and Godfather being there. Obviously, Undertaker, or rather, Yokozuna will not be there. But Undertaker used to have his little BSK faction behind the scenes, so some of the members will be there. Maybe Rikishi, you know, Fatu. I think he was part of that group. But what are they going to do? I guess that's really the question. I still think that there's going to be some sort of attack or appearance by somebody else, and it's going to lead to a match at WrestleMania, but that's just how I think this will ultimately play out. You got to have Brother Love make an appearance. Brother Love is already in the back, definitely leaving his mark on the product. And not necessarily in a good way, but he's already there. He led The Undertaker down to the ring at the Survivor Series 30 years ago. How do you not have Bruce put the makeup and the suit back on and come out as Brother Love? Make a cameo. I could see him getting a tombstone if The Undertaker can lift him, because I think Bruce has, he's gotten a little bit bigger, I think, since the last time he led The Undertaker down to the ring 30 years ago. But Brother Love, I could see him making a cameo. Ted DiBiase, before he gets sent to the big house. He may be going to the big house soon. Maybe get Ted DiBiase to come back out and introduce The Undertaker. Again, he was the man who introduced him as part of his Survivor Series team 30 years ago. But even just to be there to make an appearance, I think it would be kind of cool to have a lot of the same faces who were part of that match or part of that segment. You know, Bret Hart was part of that match. So maybe we'll get cameos from people like that as well. But you will not convince me that Vince McMahon, at the end of the day, is still not going to want this man back for a match at WrestleMania. And then the question is, does The Undertaker do it? The Undertaker always does it. Even if The Undertaker does not want to do it, if you watch The Last Ride, you know where his mind is. He just has this sense of loyalty to Vince McMahon, that he just feels like, I can't let this guy down. He's like a father figure to him. And he has, you know, guided him with this character all these years. Everything that The Undertaker has, he owes to Vince McMahon. If Vince McMahon wants him back for a match at WrestleMania, if Vince McMahon wants him back for a match in Riyadh or some other place overseas, and the payday is big, you really don't think The Undertaker wouldn't come back for one more match? And you haven't been paying attention. Some more shouts here. All people who are supporting the show this week and every week. Josh the Shooter Stockton, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Carolina Panther, Bradley Gooch, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, No Way Out, Nick Fugit, Stormy Skies, Ryan Spies, The Firebomber, Craig Foster, Daredevil, David Cook, The Wichita Lineman, Clayton Nettleton, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto. Got to shout out the Carolina Breadslinger on iTunes for showing some love for the show on there. Belt fan Brent Banner. This week on his How Did We Even Get Here podcast, he and his co-host Trey are talking missed opportunities with the ladies, the Netflix show Somebody Feed Phil, game crashing glitches on WWE 2K20, and more. You can find them on all podcast platforms or on YouTube at tinyurl.com/gethere-tube. And finally, our good friend Jeff. You all know Jeff from the Facebook group, the Maniac moderator himself, the Sound Off group messiah, Jeff Lippman. Jeff and Shah host a podcast together called The Garden of Doom, which is a variety magazine that talks about the unexplained and the abnormal, pop culture, current events, all sorts of fun stuff. And if you like myths and sci-fi and comics, you'll want to take up some gardening on the Garden of Doom podcast. Check it out on Apple Podcasts, Spreaker, and all major podcast platforms. The less said about Monday Night Raw, the better. No Fiend appearance. Just one brief segment with Nikki Cross confronting Alexa Bliss backstage and telling her that she needs to choose between her and him. And Bliss says that she chooses him. I like how reports suggest that on the company's internal chart of heels and baby faces, they have a chart. And in this column, this is all the baby faces on the brand. And in this column, these are all the people we consider to be heels on the brand. And I love how PW Insider actually had a report that The Fiend is in fact listed internally as a babyface. He's in the babyface column on that Raw roster. Only in WWE can you brainwash someone and turn them against their best friend and be considered a babyface. But that is where we are. Matt Riddle beat Jeff Hardy and Elias in a second chance qualifier to make the Raw squad at Survivor Series. AJ Styles then held a team meeting in the ring with Sheamus, Keith Lee, Matt Riddle, and Braun Strowman. Strowman looks like a child standing next to AJ's bodyguard. That's how big this guy is. And Braun Strowman is a big man. He is a big dude, and he is dwarfed by this Jordan fella who comes to the ring with AJ Styles. I love, by the way, he's this is a perfect role for him, too. I don't know how good of a worker he is. I don't think I've ever seen someone as tall and as big as he is that I would look at and go, man, this guy's a really great wrestler. So you know what? Probably better we don't see him in the ring. This is the best possible role for him. He doesn't wrestle. He doesn't even speak. He's got a nice suit on. He just stands there with his arms crossed looking all mean. He looks like he could just kill you if you look at him the wrong way. That's the perfect role for him, standing behind somebody like AJ, who's like a tiny little dwarf compared to him. That's what makes it funny. So he was out there standing in the background. But they all argued. They all argued, which is the same exact thing that happens every single year, it feels like, with this Raw team. And sometimes the SmackDown team. Riddle said, you know what we need? We all need code names. I guess so that we can, you know, in the match, we can throw off the SmackDown people by referring to each other under code names instead of our real names. And he goes, AJ, you're the skipper. Braun, you're Mongoose. Keith Lee, he said now, is Bro Lee, which may be some kind of inside joke or something. I don't know. But he said, you're Bro Lee. And Sheamus, you're Fireface. Because when you get angry, your face gets really red. And Sheamus said, oh yeah, well, what's your code name, Dopey? And then Riddle laughed and he said, how did you know, bro? I have code names. You want to hear my code names? I have code names for the people responsible for this segment. Mo, Larry, and Curly. Those are their code names. The best I can say is that even though they have Riddle out there calling himself dopey, and maybe he is dopey, but they kept him strong. They gave him not one, but two wins on this show. He not only qualified for the team by beating Jeff Hardy and Elias, but later on, there was a tag team match that came out of this segment. It was Riddle and Keith Lee against Styles, against Sheamus and Strowman. AJ was the referee for the match. And Riddle picked up the win for his team. AJ took a series of accidental bumps, and Sheamus and Strowman couldn't get along. Sheamus ended up bro-kicking him off the apron. And that's when Matt Riddle rolled up Fireface for the second win of the night. So they kept Matt Riddle pretty strong on the show, even though he called himself dopey. Speaking of Fireface, Drew McIntyre was backstage. He was getting ready for his main event. He was going to be teaming up with The New Day against Randy Orton, Miz, and Morrison. Sheamus showed up. He was venting about what just happened out there with his Raw teammates. And you know, he was talking about how the best times of our lives, man, when you and I were coming up in the business and all these different countries and all these different independent promotions, and we were a tag team, man, we had the world by the balls. He didn't say that, but that's basically what he was saying. And hey, you know, later on, let's go for a pint. You and I, let's go for a pint. And McIntyre said, I'll tell you what, we'll go out for more than one pint after I get back my WWE title next week against Randy Orton. And off he went. I'm enjoying these segments. We've had a series of these segments now, and it's very unusual for WWE to have really the top babyface on that brand fraternizing with one of the heels on the roster, which is what Sheamus is. This feels like a real human interaction between two friends. That's what I think makes it feel so unusual on a WWE show. Everything is always so very regimented in WWE, right? You don't see the heels and the baby faces kind of getting along like this. And everything is just so rehearsed and over-scripted and this. So this actually feels like a real interaction between two human beings. Very unlike WWE. It's like, the bots now have become self-aware. They have emotions. It's like number Johnny Five from Short Circuit. Every now and then you'll get one of these robots that actually a lightning strikes, and they have these human qualities about them. They step out of line. You got to try to put them back in line. So I like this segment. I like the segments they've been doing. I think these two could and should headline a pay-per-view for the WWE Championship. I just don't know that pay-per-view is going to be WrestleMania. And I'll talk more about why and what I think the WrestleMania title matches are going to be when I get to the SmackDown recap here in a few minutes. After being featured prominently from really Money in the Bank on through much of the summer, I mean, it was the Asuka show. It was to the point where they were almost featuring Asuka a little too much. And I was like, all right, just dial it back a little bit, because if you keep putting this woman on TV in so many segments, people are going to start to get sick of her and they're going to turn on her. But she was making, you know, a lot of appearances on TV and wrestling Bayley and Sasha Banks. So it was like the Asuka show. And it feels like in the span of 2 months, we have gone from the Asuka show to Asuka no show. Even though she was on the show, but it kind of feels like, boy, did they really downplay this woman. Asuka is the Raw Women's Champion and feels like a complete afterthought on this show. And because they did not bother to build up their women's division, they now have nobody credible for her to defend against outside of Charlotte Flair. She's just waiting for Charlotte to come back. Because you know that's going to be the go-to match when she comes back. It's like they're just biding time until Charlotte is ready to come back to TV. Because they don't have anybody else. With Becky being gone and Charlotte being out, there's nobody else. They did not take the time to build up anybody else on this brand. Sasha and Bayley are on the other show. So she was left here having a non-title match against Nia Jax. A match that Byron Saxton stated, and I quote, WrestleMania main event worthy, is how he described this match. WrestleMania main event worthy. He really said that. He really said those words. They were fed to him. It was not a line that he came up with on his own. Of course not, because these announcers are told, you know, what to say every minute. But just to defend Byron here, because I saw people beating up on him. Oh, Byron Saxon, so stupid. The line was fed by you-know-who, I'm sure. The line was fed into his headset to Byron Saxton. Because really, who would say such a stupid thing on their own? WrestleMania main event worthy. Nia Jax should not be headlining an independent show, let alone a WrestleMania. Nobody who, you know who would say that line? Nobody. Nobody would say that line. Nobody who isn't suffering from brain damage. Nobody would say that line. I don't think it is possible for them to make their announcers sound any less credible than they already are. We talk about the issues with the announcing on these shows. None of these announcers really have any credibility. Michael Cole's been there for, it feels like 25 years. I don't think that when people are listening to Michael Cole on TV, he comes across as the most credible person either. And it's not the announcer's fault. It's the way the announcers have been portrayed and the things that they are fed and the things that they are supposed to say on TV. Nobody can take these people credible. Nobody can credibly believe in what these people are saying. They can't believe. There's no way they can believe and buy into some of the shit that comes out of their mouths. And that is just another example. Shayna Baszler, she interfered in the match for the DQ. This woman is one half of the tag team champions, and she still feels like she's just wasting away on this show. Nia put Lana through a table for the 8th straight week. She was ringside, Lana was, for the match. She's on Team Raw with Nia, with Shayna. This is all building to Lana as the sole survivor in Survivor Series, isn't it? Is that where this is building to? Do they think that this is going to get sympathy on Lana, that Lana is going to be some kind of great babyface? Lana, she's a natural heel. But they must think that this is going to get her so much sympathy, and it'll be such a shock when she's one of the sole survivor, or one of the surviving members of the team. Which I hope she isn't, because Bianca Belair should be cleaning house and leaving with the win at Survivor Series, not Lana. Although I guess somebody could, you know, somebody could help eliminate Bianca to set up Bianca's next feud on TV, I suppose. But I wonder if that's what this is building to. Mustafa Ali, he beat Ricochet in the best match on the show with a Koji clutch. The only time you will ever hear me referring to a member of Retribution and the word best in the same sentence. So don't get used to it. Don't get too comfortable with that. That will not be happening very often on this show. And Drew McIntyre teamed up with New Day, like I said, to take on Randy Orton, The Miz, and John Morrison. They got a win over the heels. This is to build to Drew challenging Randy Orton tomorrow night live on Raw for the WWE Championship. I don't believe that we are going to be getting a title change, even though McIntyre and Roman Reigns is the more intriguing, it's the more appealing of the brand versus brand matches at Survivor Series. And they did tease it on Friday night, but that's all that it should be right now. That's all it should be, is a tease. It is a potential WrestleMania main event for them next year. Nothing is gained by doing the match now, because there can be no decisive winner. Only a non-finish or a screwy finish. Nobody wants to see that. That is a match that should be preserved. Which brings me to SmackDown. Perfect segue. Drew McIntyre showed up on SmackDown this week to confront the Tribal Chief. As Drew, again, is getting that rematch with Randy Orton tomorrow night, he could walk out of Raw as the WWE Champion. And he could well end up facing Roman Reigns at Survivor Series, and so he wanted to confront Roman face-to-face. The brand-to-brand invitational lives, I suppose. And here we go. Here we go. The rivalry that Triple H recently, only a few weeks ago, I think it was in some virtual Comic-Con panel, Triple H recently said that this feud, when these two guys eventually get together, Roman Reigns and Drew McIntyre, who already feuded, by the way, they had a match at WrestleMania 35 that's sort of forgotten about, but they've never had like a big-time main event level feud. Triple H recently made the comment that this program, this feud, in the next couple of years could be this generation's Hulk Hogan versus Ric Flair or Stone Cold against The Rock. Why would you even make that comparison? I know what he's trying to say, but it just gets people hung up on comparisons, and comparisons are not what they need right now. Roman and Drew could be a hell of a feud. But please, do not compare it to Austin and The Rock. Of all the things to compare people to, you talk about handicapping people. You're comparing them to Stone Cold and The Rock? There is no comparison, not in today's WWE. There can never be another rivalry like Stone Cold Steve Austin against The Rock. Not in today's WWE, the way they do television, just as different as things are. It can't happen. It is not possible. It is not possible. They do these guys no favors when they make these comparisons. Again, I know what he was trying to say, but some things are better left unsaid. And I think that's one of those things that he would have been better off either rephrasing or just keeping to himself. Roman Reigns did, however, have the line of the night. He had the line of the week. I consider this a work shoot with this comment. He made the comment to Drew McIntyre. He said, "I don't watch Raw. Nobody does. Nobody watches that show because they're all watching SmackDown, and they're all watching SmackDown because they're all watching me." Truer words, I do not believe, have ever left the lips of Roman Reigns. That is the most honest thing that I have ever heard him say on WWE television in, what has he been on TV now, for 6 years? 8 years? That was it? End of 2012. 8 years. Wow, that's a long time. And I love, by the way, how the minute that Roman said, "I don't watch Raw," if you heard in the background, Paul Heyman was standing behind him. Paul Heyman just goes, "You're not missing much," says the former executive director of Monday Night Raw. Anyway, this brought out Jey Uso, who came out of his own volition. Clearly, Roman Reigns did not want him to come out here, but Jey Uso was sticking up for the family, and this ended up with a match being made, Drew McIntyre in the main event against Jey Uso. Roman was pissed in the back. He was just shouting at Jey Uso, "What are you doing? You know, you don't have a match unless I say you have a match." So he was not happy about that. And in the main event, may as well just skip to that part, McIntyre pinned Jey Uso off of a Claymore kick. It was a non-sanctioned match because Drew was not part of the Blue Brand, which never stopped people from going over there because apparently you could just go wherever you want. It's Survivor Series season, so therefore you can just go wherever you want. I don't know how that's any different than what we had in the summer. They did that for SummerSlam season. They're doing it for Survivor Series season. Royal Rumble is going to be the same thing, right? Because Royal Rumble, everybody mixes together. WrestleMania, you have some mixing. I don't know why they still try to keep up this farce that the Survivor Series is the one time of year. You could take that and shove it up your ass. Again, no credibility with these announcers. None. There's another example of it. None. Zero. Zip. Zilch. Goose egg. No credibility. But he beat Jey Uso, and he confronted Roman Reigns when the match was over, and Roman looked at his title, which was over his shoulder, and he looked at Drew and he said, "Go win one of these, and then we can talk about next Sunday." And he walked to the back. So things are very muddied right now. The match for Survivor Series at the moment is Randy Orton, and these are all non-title. The match at the moment is Randy Orton one-on-one with Roman Reigns. And neither man can really afford a loss right now. Randy Orton lost plenty before he finally won the title at Hell in a Cell from Drew. He lost to Drew two or three times before that. He lost to Keith Lee. Now he's the champion. Randy Orton, really shouldn't be losing. Roman Reigns should not be losing at least until WrestleMania. At least. And yet on Raw, they have been teasing an Orton Fiend program or Orton McIntyre and the Fiend. The Fiend has no match at the moment at Survivor Series. And tomorrow night on Raw, now we know that Randy Orton defends the title against Drew McIntyre, which theoretically could set up McIntyre against Reigns at Survivor Series. But then you have the same problem where neither man should really be losing. This is always the problem when you do these interbrand matches. but it just feels way too soon to be jumping into that match. So here's what I think. I think that Drew showed up on SmackDown this week, right? Tomorrow night, what's good for one is good for the other. Roman Reigns makes an appearance on Monday Night Raw. And that, I don't even want to say interference, but even if just him showing up as a distraction leads to McIntyre failing to win back the championship, maybe The Fiend gets involved. Because remember, The Fiend is involved in this whole program here, but I don't believe that McIntyre is winning that title. But I think by showing up that way, Roman, he keeps Drew on ice for a while. You keep that on the back burner. And your two WrestleMania main events next year could be Randy Orton defending the WWE title against Edge, which just, if Orton keeps the title, that's the obvious direction. There's no other direction. Unless Edge is not recovering as quickly as he would like to from his injury, he'll be back in time for WrestleMania. He may be back in time for the Royal Rumble. He may win the fucking Rumble. So if Orton doesn't drop the belt in the next couple of months, then that is the obvious direction for WrestleMania. Orton against Edge. I'm not thrilled about it being for the championship, because I don't think it has to be. But clearly Orton and Edge are having one more match. And Drew, you got to figure out a way to get him on SmackDown, because he between he and Edge, there's a better chance, I think, of Edge coming back and winning the Royal Rumble than there is of Drew repeating 2 years in a row. And that could be how Edge gets his shot with Randy. I'm still pulling for a Big E win, but I gotta tell you, Big E has just been ice cold these past several weeks. Barely even featured on television, but for a few backstage segments with the Street Profits. And that really is just to build up a tag team match at Survivor Series between the Street Profits and the New Day. It's not even really a focus so much on Big E. So I don't have high hopes that they see him as being ready for that spot just yet. Reigns and McIntyre would be a WrestleMania-worthy match. And the dynamic is totally different from the match they had at WrestleMania 35. That was a total afterthought on the card. And it didn't help that it came after Kofi's big win against Daniel Bryan. It's like nobody gave a shit about the Roman Reigns. I was in the building, I could tell you. Nobody cared about the Roman Reigns-Drew McIntyre match. It was just sort of one and done. Roman wins. All right, get him out of there. Because everybody was drained from the Kofi win, and they were still waiting for the Ronda Rousey, Becky Lynch, Charlotte main event, which didn't even start until midnight. So people were just completely exhausted by that point. But the dynamic was totally different. Roman was the babyface coming back from cancer, and Drew McIntyre was the heel. Totally different situation. The dynamic is totally different. Now the roles are completely reversed. And Roman is doing the best work of his career right now. If they can't get The Rock, and I don't think they will, I think that's probably the match. Reigns and McIntyre. And the interactions between them on Friday night were great. You know, when they were together, it really did feel like the biggest match outside of The Rock that they could be doing with Roman Reigns. Chad Gable. His new gimmick is handing out a pamphlet for something that he's calling the Alpha Academy. He handed one to Otis backstage, after Otis's win over Dolph Ziggler. He told Otis what he did to Ziggler, what you just did out there to Dolph Ziggler, you need to start doing that every week. And he said that, Otis, you know what you need? You need a mentor. And he handed him the pamphlet. It's funny, you know, I was pitching Jason Jordan as the mentor to Chad Gable to get Jordan back on TV and get a little American Alpha reunion going on. But instead, they're going to go with Gable in the mentor role instead. Or are they? When Otis walked away, all excited, he took the pamphlet, he was all happy, he walked off, the camera zoomed in on Chad Gable, and he had this evil look on his face, like he had just lured this man into a trap. It did not come across like they're going to form a new tag team. Gable and Otis, for those who don't know, they are best friends. If you've never seen their training videos together, you can check out either one of their Instagrams. They're always filming each other while they're training in the gym or their garage or whatever. They've been best friends for a long time. Their friendship goes back about 10 years to the days they spent living together in the Olympic Training Center They were both training for the Olympics, and all of the time that they spent hanging out outside of their training was spent watching pro wrestling. So, you know, Gable got his name back, and now he gets to work with his best friend. And it gives Otis something to do, which is more than I can say for Tucker. We had a no-holds-barred match billed as the final chapter between Seth Rollins and Rey Mysterio. And did you notice that Rey's injured eye was miraculously healed? He didn't have the eye patch covering on his mask. His eye was just completely back to normal. An amazing recovery from a detached eyeball. Or gumball. So, I guess his eye grew back. He doesn't need the patch anymore. His eye grew back. They had a very good match. Rollins pulled the rubber tips off the bottom legs of a steel chair, tried to drive it down back into Rey's eye. Trying to blind this man again. Dominic tried to stop him. He tried to save his dad. The whole family was out there. The entire Mysterio clan was outside the ring. Angie, Aaliyah, Dominic, Murphy was over in Seth's corner. Because remember, he was the disciple again. Even though you knew that there was something up his sleeve. But he was in Rollins' corner. And of course, he was in fact setting up Rollins for the fall. All along, he caught him with a running knee strike. Murphy left the ring after the knee strike, and he's standing outside. And Rollins crawls over to the ropes, so now he doesn't even realize he's in the position for the 619 as he is yelling at Murphy outside the ring. And Rey Mysterio comes off the ropes, and we had a rare 619 botch by Rey Mysterio. You know how Rey, when he does it, he holds on to the top rope. It looks like he just missed the rope. He sort of fell through the ropes out of the ring. And he came back, he did it again. He recovered, and he hit the 619 the second time. He climbed up to the top rope. And here on this 15-year anniversary of the death of one of his best friends, Eddie Guerrero, he does the Eddie pose and hits a frog splash for the win. 1, 2, 3. Rey Mysterio is victorious. Aaliyah, she wants to make a beeline for Murphy to hug him. Rey stops her. Puts his hand out and he stops her. Rey looks over on the apron. Murphy is standing and he tells Murphy, get in the ring. You want my respect? Get in the ring. And he puts his hand out and he shakes hands with Murphy. And then Aaliyah comes over and hugs him, and Murphy shakes hands with Dominic. And we ended with the Mysterios and Murphy. Even Angie came over and she hugged Murphy. And we ended with this great, it was like the scene out of a Christmas movie, right? The whole family is reunited. The family is back together. 'Tis the season. The Mysterio family is one big happy unit. And you know, I couldn't help it. I got all emotional. It's just a beautiful thing to see, you know? I'm so happy. I'm so happy, you know, because not that I'm happy necessarily about, you know, Rey approving of his daughter dating somebody 13 years older. That's a little weird, but, you know, finally, the end. The end of this storyline. It brings tears to my eyes. The final chapter. Oh, finally. 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 We are done with this. Although, we are getting Rollins against Murphy this Friday night on SmackDown in what may be Seth's final appearance for a while. Remember, Becky Lynch is due to have her child next month. We're only a few weeks away from the birth of the baby Messiah. And so I think Rollins may be going away. He doesn't even have a match for Survivor Series. So I think he loses to Murphy, puts Murphy over on his way out. I'm sure Seth will be back in time for the Royal Rumble. I can't imagine he would miss that. So I don't think he'll be gone for very long, but this could be the final appearance. This could be the final appearance for the Monday night Messiah. Well, I mean, I guess he's not on Mondays anymore. It may be the last time we see the Friday night fuckface on TV for a while. And then there's Chelsea Green. Poor Chelsea Green. who had not been seen on television since May, when she fired Robert Stone as her manager on NXT. I love how she fired Robert Stone because she was going on to bigger and better things. Yet Robert Stone has continued to appear on NXT television, and Chelsea Green has not been heard from ever since. It's like she hasn't even existed. She fell off the face of the earth. Then a few months ago, she tested positive for COVID. So it's not been a great year for Chelsea Green. It was made even worse on Friday night. So she returned to the main roster on this show. I say returned because she's made sporadic appearances before. She had a match on Raw once against Charlotte Flair. She was in the Women's Royal Rumble earlier this year. So she's made appearances here and there. But this, I think, was supposed to be her formal debut on the main roster. Adam Pearce had put Natty in a triple threat match on this show against Liv Morgan and Tamina for a spot on Team SmackDown, the women's team, at Survivor Series. And at the last minute, all the ladies are in the ring, the triple threat is about to begin, and the ring announcer says, "But wait, there's more." And this has now been made a fatal four-way. We have one more participant, and out comes Chelsea Green. This is her big debut. And not 60 seconds into this match, she gets drop-kicked off the apron by Liv Morgan to the floor and immediately grabs her left wrist. And we never saw her again. Clearly, there was something going on off-camera. We couldn't see it. They wouldn't show it. But there were a lot of rest holds. There seemed to be a lot of confusion. They had to call an audible here. The reason we never saw her again is because she broke her wrist. She broke her wrist for the second time. This is the second time that she has broken her left wrist in the past 2 years. The same one. And the first time happened to be in her debut match on NXT television, which I don't know if that ever actually aired or not. I don't remember if they aired the match or not, but it was her NXT TV debut. And she broke her wrist, and she won, I think. She finished the match, but it's just kind of weird how this all works out sometimes. Her debut match there, and then it happened same wrist in her debut match here. She confirmed the injury on Instagram. And by the way, Liv Morgan ended up winning. So Liv Morgan is now on the women's team at Survivor Series, which makes sense because Ruby Riott is already on the team, so now Liv Morgan joins her. But she confirmed the injury on Instagram later that night. She had surgery the next morning. Now, she was back in the ring 3 months after breaking it the first time. I think she broke it in March. She was back by June. So that may give us a sense of how long she'll be out for this time, unless this break was worse. I mean, she posted the x-rays. I don't know what I'm looking at as compared to her last injury. You could see the break in the x-ray. I don't know if it's just a clean break. I don't know if it was worse than a clean break. I don't know. But she was out for about 3 months the first time. So I would not expect her back in any less than 3 months this time. But, you know, I mean, the thing about this, though, is I have every reason. I haven't read this anywhere, so I don't know for a fact, but I'm watching this thinking she's winning the match. Why else would Chelsea Green be added at the last minute to this match unless she was being added to the Survivor Series team and they were going to give her a push right out of the gate, you know, coming out of her debut? So I believe that she was going to win this match. And then they had to scramble and say, all right, well, she's hurt, so let's go with Liv. That's what I think happened here. But even if she was going to win, this is how you handle Chelsea Green's debut. She shows up, doesn't speak, but she shows up in a backstage vignette with Adam Pearce, Commissioner Pearce. There he is again. I love how they call WWE official Adam Pearce. Just call him what he is. He's the fucking commissioner. He's the president. He's the commissioner. He's whatever. General manager, right? They love having GMs in the past. That's basically what Adam Pearce has become. But there she is in the background, and she's smiling, and then they go to commercial. And then they come back, and we find out that she's been added to the match. I don't know if we're supposed to think that she did some kind of favor for Adam Pearce. I mean, really, what are we supposed to think here? There's Adam Pearce, here's a beautiful woman who's smiling at him, and we come back from commercial, and all of a sudden she's been added to the match. Okay. I guess let your imagination run wild there, but this is how they debut her? Really? This is how they debut her on the main roster? There's no build-up. There's no vignettes. Nothing like that. Just here she is. Here's Chelsea Green. You could probably hear a pin drop when she came out. Well, I guess you would because there's nobody in the building. What am I saying? It's all fake noise. I had to remind myself. It's all fake noise. So I wasn't impressed by the way they were even debuting her. And then for this to happen, this was just stupid. This just didn't have to happen. I mean, obviously the injury was just a freak occurrence. But I wasn't impressed with the way they were even debuting her. They've known for months. This woman has been waiting. This is the best they could come up with for Chelsea Green. We'll just throw her on TV in a random match. And maybe have her win and then go on to Survivor Series. That's their great way of debuting her. Anyway. The problem is, Liv Morgan, I said she got the win. But there's still, I think, one spot left. I believe is there one spot left? I think there is. It's Ruby, Liv, and Bianca. So there's two, actually. I think there's two spots left on that team at Survivor Series on Team SmackDown. Natty is almost surely going to end up on this team. Because who else do they have? They fired Zelina. Chelsea just got hurt. Sasha is the champion. She's already wrestling Asuka. That leaves Billy Kay, Carmella, who I could see getting involved in the Sasha match, not necessarily being part of this one. Mickie James, I don't know what her status is. She had broken her nose, but I think that was 2 months ago. I'm sure she's fine now. I don't know what her status is. And then there's Bayley, and Bayley has nothing to do on this pay-per-view. A woman is SmackDown Women's Champion for over a year, and as of today, she has no spot on this show. So I think Natty will make the team. Bayley probably will just by process of elimination. And you could have Bayley and Bianca kind of fighting it out over who the real team captain is. Maybe that's the idea. I could see Lana ending up as the sole survivor in this fucking match. And I could see Bianca maybe being eliminated because if Bayley is on the team, maybe the program coming out of Survivor Series is Bayley and Bianca Belair. You got to start building up Bianca soon for WrestleMania. I think that Bianca and Sasha is the match to do for the women's title of WrestleMania. And she's going to have to start beating some credible people. Well, there's very few people on that roster in the women's division more credible right now than Bayley. Bayley just celebrated a year plus as the women's champion. So if they're on the same team and there's jealousy there on Bayley's part, you know, she could, you know, actually cost Bianca. Maybe Bianca gets the dreaded roll up or something where Bayley and Bianca end up battling out of the building or something. Yeah, I could envision a few different scenarios that end up with Lana being the sole survivor in that match. And as she's celebrating, then Nia Jax puts her through the announce desk for the 9th time or the 10th time. I guess let's assume she'll be put through a table tomorrow night. Survivor Series would be number 10. Maybe that's the payoff. They want to get to 10. 10 is at Survivor Series. She wins, she's celebrating, and then Nia puts her through the table. And then we can be done with this. 10 times through the table, that's enough. Anyway, that was SmackDown. Slightly more enjoyable than Raw. I actually thought SmackDown was not nearly as good this week as it's been in recent weeks. It was a step down, but still a step up from Monday Night Raw. Hey, when you use the bathroom, you always close the door behind you, right? You don't want some random person looking in on you. So why would you let people look in on you when you go online? Using the internet without ExpressVPN, it's like going to the bathroom and not closing the door. Did you know that your internet service provider, like Comcast or Verizon, knows every single website that you visit? And what's worse is that they can sell this information to ad companies and tech giants who will use your data to target you. ExpressVPN puts a stop to this. It creates a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet so that your online activity can't be seen by anyone. I use ExpressVPN on all my devices. It works on everything. Phones, laptops, even routers. So everyone who shares your Wi-Fi can still be protected even if they don't have ExpressVPN. And the best part is, using ExpressVPN is as easy as closing the bathroom door. You just fire up the app, click one button, and you're protected. ExpressVPN is the world's number one rated VPN by CNET, Wired, The Verge, and countless others. So if you're like me and you believe that your online activity is your business and yours alone, Secure yourself by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. Visit today. Use my exclusive link for Sound Off listeners, expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster, and you can get an extra 3 months free. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. Got a bunch of AEW news and notes this week. I mentioned this on the Dynamite stream on Wednesday. And by the way, I got to thank everybody every week who joins me live on Wednesday nights. I'm there every single week, 10 p.m. Wednesdays, as soon as AEW Dynamite goes off the air, as I will be this Wednesday as well. But talked about the AEW games news a little bit on Wednesday, and I'll mention it again here. They made a big announcement on Tuesday. AEW announced 3 new games that they currently have in development: a console game and 2 mobile games. And the console game, which currently has no name, is being developed by Yuke's, which worked with 2K, and even before 2K, they've been working for years. They had worked for many, many years on WWE games. Some really good ones, and maybe some not as good ones, but I think overall they had a pretty good rep as far as their work on the WWE games. They were not involved in the poorly received 2K20 release. And most people were also very excited by the announcement that Hideyuki Iwashita is going to be part of this project. He is helping to develop the new console game. He was the director for the classic WWF No Mercy game that came out many years ago for the Nintendo 64. He has signed on to help develop this new game. No Mercy was beloved because of how easy the controls were. I think that really, more than anything, is probably what people really loved about that game. It's the kind of game you could just sort of pick up and play. You don't have to worry about memorizing button combos and things of that nature. So the hope is that he'll be able to bring some of that to this new game. But you take the best from a game like No Mercy. You take maybe the best from some of those SmackDown vs. Raw games in terms of how those games looked and worked, and you merge them together, and you could potentially have a winner on your hands. You never really know until the game comes out. I mean, look at 2K20, for God's sakes. But people are waiting for more gameplay. We only got a little snippet of it. People are waiting for more. No word on exactly when that'll be out. The 2 mobile games, one of them is a casino game called AEW Casino Double or Nothing. That's coming out in the winter. And there's also going to be AEW Elite General Manager, dropping sometime in 2021, where you get to basically run your own promotion and put together a roster. You got to try to generate revenue. Both games are going to be playable on iOS and Android. So that is the games update for all you gamers out there. Now let's talk a little bit about Cody here. Cody was on the AEW Unrestricted podcast this past week, and he talked about unprotected chair shots to the head in terms of the one that he took from Sean Spears last year at Fyter Fest, the one that went horribly wrong, and the one which Tony Khan and Jon Moxley both chewed out Spears for when he got to the back. As soon as he got to the back, I'm sure that must have been a great feeling. This was his big AEW debut. And the first thing that happens when he goes to the back is he's being yelled at by the president, and he's being yelled at by one of the top stars in the company. And they are chewing him out. Cody says that he takes the blame for what happened because he was the one who told Sean Spears to hit him from the side with the chair, and he told Spears, swing for the fences. But in this interview, he made a very odd, I thought, also very dumb remark when arguing that since Hollywood action movies pull off violent-looking blows to the head, then there must be a way for pro wrestlers to be able to do the same. He said, wrestling is violent, people get hurt, this is not ballet, you've heard all of this stuff. Now, I don't want anyone to get hurt if we're going to be held to the same standard as TV and film, which some people would like to hold us to those same standards. We have a comparable reach. We have global penetration, pop culture-wise. Well, then if Captain America can be swinging his shield around, hitting people in the head with it, no one's crying headshots. No one is blaming this modern generation for whatever the hell they did in 1990-something with Mick and Rock in Shamrock. That's not our fault. So I wanted to take chair shots to the head back for the boys. But I wanted to do it safely. First of all, please do not ever utter the words, "take chair shots to the head back for the boys," ever again. That is just truly one of the dumbest things I've ever heard. Second of all, arguing that since Captain America bashes people in the head or over the head in the Marvel movies with his shield, then why can't pro wrestlers, you know, gimmick their chairs and do the same thing? That is not the same thing, like, at all. Pro wrestling does not need chair shots of the head anymore. Gimmicked or otherwise, they don't need it. They looked cool. They sounded cool when they were happening all the time. It was just, hey, it's just wrestling, right? Everybody just chalked it up to it being pro wrestling. There have been some wicked sounding chair shots to the head, to the face. Different time. You're talking 20, 25 years ago, different time. That was then, this is now. He talked about how the chair was gimmicked and how the head of their props department got fired for the incident and he was reassigned elsewhere, I guess, within the company. So he was more reassigned, I guess, than fired. Cody also said this week that he only plans to wrestle 5 more years and then he wants to run for a Senate seat in the state of Georgia. He's not doing his political career, his future political aspirations, any favors when he makes comments like this. I heard that quote, I cringed. I seized up a little bit. Take chair shots to the head, back for the boys. Yeah, I think your priorities could be best put elsewhere when it comes to what you can be doing for the other talent. I wouldn't worry so much about chair shots to the head. We can leave that one in the dustbin of wrestling history. We have our replays, we have our WWE Network and our VHS tapes and our DVDs and our YouTube clips if we want to go back and watch some wicked chair shots to the head. And for all the ones that looked cool and sounded cool, you also had some sickening ones. Like the ones that Mankind took at the Rumble in 99 to the tune of, what, 15 of them? The one that Undertaker gave to Mr. Kennedy, which is one of the sickest things I've ever seen. We can leave those in the dustbin. We don't need to take them back. Gimmicked or otherwise, we don't need to take them back. Cody and Shaq. They had a tease on Dynamite this week for a potential match, a potential showdown between Cody Rhodes and Shaquille O'Neal, or at least I assume Shaquille O'Neal. They never actually said Shaquille O'Neal. I said on the Dynamite review, I mean, all they said was Shaq. We don't know if that's the Shaq. It could be Radio Shaq. It could be Shake Shaq. It could be any kind of Shaq. Love Shaq. It could all be a swerve. But if it is Shaq, I'll say, well, Vince McMahon, he's going to be pissed. Shaq, who did some stuff over the years with WWE, right? He's going to be pissed. Shaq is bringing that Icy Hot sponsorship over to AEW like Randy Savage, bringing Slim Jim over to WCW. We're going to see him. It's going to be as if Shaq no longer exists. He's going to be dead to him. He won't acknowledge him. But they had a segment on Dynamite, which was equal parts terrible and equal parts fantastic, I thought, for the Brandi Rhodes promo. Cody was in the ring. He was confronted by this woman who we have never seen before on Dynamite. She has been seen or spotted in the crowd on AEW Dark, but she has not made her formal debut, at least not up until this point. Jade Cargill, who has been signed to a contract. They put a press release out announcing her signing with the company. I'll even read a little bit of it just to give some background on who she is. AEW today announced a multi-year deal with rising wrestling sensation Jade Cargill, who made an electric debut last night on Dynamite. And then they went on to explain exactly what she did. It says Jade, who played basketball at Jacksonville University in Jacksonville, Florida, brings a high level of athleticism and intensity to the AEW women's division. With her background as a professional trainer and explosive demeanor on the mic, I don't know about that. Jade is poised to make a powerful impression inside and outside the ring. She was anything but explosive. on the microphone. This is her first time cutting a live promo on TV. She seemed nervous. She seemed very scripted and rehearsed. I didn't think it was very good. Maybe she got a little bit more comfortable as it went on. That promo, that whole part of the segment, I thought was pretty much trash until Brandi Rhodes came out. And Brandi Rhodes came out and she wigged out on Jade. And I didn't do it the exact way that Brandi did it, but I read the promo word for word on the Dynamite review. If you want to go back and listen to me cutting Brandi's promo for her, it was kind of ridiculous. But what I loved about the Brandi Rhodes promo was it came across as authentic. It came across as somebody completely the opposite of how the Cargill promo came off, which, like I said, was very scripted and rehearsed, and she had never really done that before. So I understand that maybe they don't trust her in that spot yet. Brandi came out. She was pissed. And she went off on this woman, and it was fantastic. I loved that part of it. The rest of it, I didn't think was very good at all. But the whole point here is she made the comment that, you know, Cody, you've called yourself in the past, which he has. He's referred to himself as the Giant Killer, although I think he only did that one time. And it might have been after he beat Lance Archer. But you're not the real Giant Killer, and that's where the Shaq tease came into play. Now, if you remember when Shaq was interviewed, and this is going back maybe a couple of months, he was interviewed about a new contract that he had signed with the Turner organization. You know, he's on the Inside the NBA show on TNT. He's part of the TNT family. He had something inserted into his contract that has to do with pro wrestling because he loves pro wrestling and he wants to be part of Dynamite in some way. And I think we may have just found out what that way is. It looks like they're setting up for a match. Now, it may not be a match. It may end up being that Shaq makes a one-time appearance. Maybe he's a guest ring enforcer. Maybe it's something similar to what they did with Mike Tyson. Yeah, Mike Tyson never did a match. They wanted him to. They wanted to do Jericho and Tyson it all out. Jericho said that was the plan. Chris Jericho one-on-one with Mike Tyson. And when that didn't happen, they ended up getting an extra match out of the Orange Cassidy feud. So maybe Shaq isn't coming in for a match. I hope not. There's good and there's bad with this. The bad is the idea that Shaq would do a singles match. Shaq is not a trained professional wrestler. He came in WWE. He was part of the Andre Battle Royal one year. Constantly was teasing a possible match with Big Show, and it never happened. And it's a good thing it probably never happened, but the idea that he's going to get in there with a smaller guy, at least Big Show is, you know, he's a big guy like Shaq is. Cody is just dwarfed by Shaq. But the idea that Shaq at the age of 47 or 48 is going to come in and have a singles match is ridiculous. Now, if you want to do a tag team match and he's kind of like in and out, you could do something like that. The good part of this is getting Shaq on AEW television. That's a big coup. If they can get him on the show even just one time, if they want to promote something in advance, Shaq, you know, in 2 weeks is going to be here for, you know, a tag team match, or he's going to referee a match, they could pop a big rating. But to me, you know, that's probably all it's going to be. You're popping a one-time big rating. We know that Jon Moxley and Kenny Omega are wrestling for the AEW Championship on December 2nd, and it makes me wonder if they're going to promote that episode of Dynamite as a really big show, and beyond just the main event, whatever they're going to do with Shaq, maybe they're going to save it for the December 2nd show, and just take that one night and really build it up as something big. If they do, by the way, I fully expect in about a week or two to get the announcement from WWE that we're getting NXT Super Brawl on December 2nd. I mean, we know how Triple H loves to resurrect those old WCW shows. He did the same thing with the Great American Bash in July. We just had Halloween Havoc. If AEW has a pay-per-view-esque episode of Dynamite that they're going to be promoting, it's only a matter of time. NXT World War III, NXT Super Brawl, NXT Starcade. So I would watch for that. I would watch to see if they announce something else for December 2nd, and that could possibly be it. So again, on the one hand, great promotion for AEW. On the other hand, getting Shaq in the ring for a singles match, if that were to be the idea, sounds like a disaster waiting to happen. So Let's see where this goes. We've been teased by Shaq stuff before in WWE. That just ends up not happening. Same thing happened with Tyson. They could promote Shaq all they want. That doesn't mean he'll actually come in. But I get the sense he wants to. I get the sense this time he will. This time he would do something because it's just something he genuinely thinks would be a lot of fun to do. And it would get eyeballs on the AEW product. No doubt about that. The more eyeballs they can get, the better. I feel like the ratings in recent weeks, you know, even with all the election stuff being over, the ratings this week, I think they were up slightly for both shows, but they're still not great. It feels like we're almost kind of in this dead period right now. They have some fans in the building for Dynamite, but not as many as they used to. They've got to try to drum up interest in some way, and that could be one way of doing that. Now, Pac is back. Pac was back on Dynamite this past week, exactly as I figured. They were doing the Lucha Bros Part 2 for some reason, and that was the reason. Pentagon beat Phoenix. Not only did he beat his brother, he beat the fuck out of him. Gave him a package pile driver on the apron. He gave him a destroyer on the floor. He gave him another package pile driver in the ring. He tried to kill this man. And then after the match, Eddie Kingston, literally, he kind of kicked Phoenix out of the ring, and he was trying to convince Pentagon, you don't need him, he's dead weight. Out comes Pac, went after Eddie Kingston. That's going to be the feud going forward. Omega and Moxley, I mentioned, are official. December 2nd, AEW Championship on the line. Why are they doing it then and not waiting and trying to drag this out for either some other big event or even the Revolution pay-per-view in February? Maybe they just feel it's too far away. Some speculation, and I kind of look at this and I think it all makes sense. You know, I know Meltzer is saying that no, there's no plans right now for any of the AEW talent to do Wrestle Kingdom, but Jon Moxley is the IWGP United States Champion. If they were going to take the title away from Moxley and strip him, they probably would have done it by now. I think they're waiting for and they're hoping, and Moxley is hoping, to be able to go back and drop that belt. Wrestle Kingdom is coming up. Kenta has the briefcase, which entitles him to a U.S. title match. There's been no official match announced yet for him on that show. There's two nights of Wrestle Kingdom again this year. If Moxley was to do Wrestle Kingdom, he would likely have to leave a couple of weeks in advance, whether it's to quarantine or just travel there and then quarantine before the show. And then after the show, it would probably be another 2 weeks at least before he could even possibly return to Dynamite. Now, if he's the AEW champion, that makes it a lot more difficult. You're not going to take your AEW world champion and let him go wrestle for someone else at the expense of not having him on your own show for a month. That's crazy. If I'm Tony Khan, I'm like, yeah, you're not doing that. I'm gonna not have you available for 4 weeks, potentially 4 or 5 weeks. That's insane. However, if he drops the title to Kenny Omega on December 2nd, Kenny Omega now is the champion. And depending on whether or not they shoot some kind of injury angle or something, which I don't know if that would work, because then, you know, there he is on New Japan television. That would be kind of strange. But at least if the belt is off of him, yeah, then you could take him off TV for a few weeks and let Kenny go ahead, and Kenny can do his own thing. So this just seems prime to me to have Kenny Omega take the championship and let Jon Moxley go off to defend his other title against Kenta at one of the two Tokyo Dome shows at the beginning of January. That's what I think is happening here. Tony Khan tweeted before Dynamite, said, for the rest of 2020, AEW will keep delivering great matches on Wednesday nights, and there are massive surprises ahead. Please join us on TNT tonight. The balance of power in wrestling will shift tonight. And that tweet got a lot of people talking. When Dynamite was over, there were a lot of very disappointed people going, is that it? Pac? I mean, we like Pac, but Pac coming back? That's the big balance of power shift that Tony Khan was talking about. Now, later on, he sought to clarify what he meant when the show was over. He said, thank you, everybody who watched. A shift in wrestling's balance of power has begun, and the winners will be the wrestling fans. Pac returned after 8 months, and I have aces up the sleeve in weeks ahead. You won't get them all at once, but you will get them all. And he also told PW Insider, there's more to come. Pac coming back is the beginning of a huge push for the rest of the year. Balance of Power in storyline refers to Eddie Kingston's strong power base as a character which could be threatened, but it could also refer to the big push that AEW is making for the rest of the year into December and into 2021. So he kind of backtracked a little bit because I think he realized, you know, maybe he should have either clarified that a little bit sooner, or maybe he should have used a different choice of words. You got to be careful. When you tweet stuff like that, you know that it only serves to whip people up into a frenzy and get their hopes up. They hear something like the balance of power will shift, and they're thinking big. They're not thinking Pac. They're not thinking Eddie Kingston. They're thinking, oh, he's got something really big planned. Some big show closing angle. That was a big show closing angle, but it wasn't balance of power shifting. So I think that was a mistake for him to use that kind of language. Now, Dynamite this Wednesday night has a pretty packed lineup. We're going to get footage of the Inner Circle's trip to Las Vegas. MJF and Wardlow have officially been initiated into the Inner Circle against the wishes of Ortiz and against the wishes of Sammy Guevara. There's already still photos leaking from them in Vegas, so I guess we're going to get clips from their little Vegas vacation. Pac takes on The Blade. Darby Allin and Cody team up to take on Team Taz, Brian Cage and Ricky Starks. Orange Cassidy takes on Kip Sabian. The Young Bucks, non-title match against the new team of Top Flight. Getting a lot of buzz in wrestling circles. It's two brothers, Darius and Dante Martin. Very young. I think the youngest of the two of them is, I don't know which one, but one of them's only 19 years old. What happened is they had sent Matt Jackson a video some time ago showing some of their work, and he was blown away and he wanted to bring them in right away. I did not see their recent match on Dark when they debuted, so this is going to be my first time seeing them in action on Wednesday night. And the NWA Women's Champion, Serena Deeb, will defend her title against the former champion, Thunder Rosa. Thunder Rosa was on Busted Open Radio this week, and she said that with all of her side projects, as far as what company she sees herself potentially working for in the future, it has to be a place that would allow her to continue working on the stuff that she is doing. She's part owner of an all-women's promotion called Mission Pro Wrestling. She's got her MMA stuff. She's not done with that. She says if she's able to do that while working for the NWA, then she'll stick with the NWA. She's not going anywhere because she's locked down through next year with the NWA. So even if she makes a move, it won't be for, you know, you say through 2021. I don't know if that means December of next year. I don't know if that means the middle of the year. Whenever her deal with the NWA is up, it won't be until well into 2021. So she's not going anywhere anyway. But she says, if I can stay with the NWA and do all of these other things, then maybe I'll stay with the NWA. If AEW would allow it, then maybe I'll consider going to AEW. She says, knowing how things are in WWE, it sounds like an unlikely destination for her. That's what it sounds like. Because it would prevent her from working on all of the things that she is passionate about. You know, it's not like if you work for WWE, it's not as if you can't do anything outside. Like, a lot of guys have wrestling schools. You know, I've heard that when Seth Rollins is not, you know, on TV or on the road working, you know, for WWE, he's almost always at his, I think it's Black and Brave Academy. Like, he's very hands-on there. He's got a coffee shop that he runs. Like, there are people who are allowed to have, like, side businesses, I guess, so long as they don't conflict with WWE. So, yeah, some people are allowed to work on those types of things, but a lot of the stuff that Thunder Rosa is describing, there's no way she would be allowed to do that if she were working for WWE. And it sounds like she recognizes that. She says, I don't want to have that joy taken away from me for money. I'd rather be happy than enslaved somewhere where I'm going to be there for who knows how long. I think that comment is very telling. And if you are one of those people who are very worried about her signing with WWE and just kind of getting stockpiled like so many other people are there, it sounds like you can breathe a sigh of relief, because that does not sound like a woman who is on her way to WWE anytime in the near future. NXT, just some very quick thoughts here before we move on NXT. The big news really coming out of the show is that we have a new champion. And it's not the NXT champion. Although we are going to hear from Finn Balor next week. So this Wednesday. I don't know if he's going to relinquish the title. If he's mostly healed up, then he should be able to come back soon. We'll get that update from him on Wednesday. But we have a new North American champion, and his name is Leon Ruff. Johnny Gargano was in the ring with a wheel, and he made some silly puns, you know, where there's a wheel, there's a way, and he was going to spin the wheel to choose his next opponent. The wheel was rigged. It was going in one direction, and then it went back the other direction, and then finally it landed on a spot that had Leon Ruff's name scribbled on a piece of masking tape. Leon Ruff was a signing when Evolve was purchased by WWE. I think it was shortly thereafter he signed a contract this summer with WWE. So he's only been signed for a few months. Leon Ruff, what I know of him, he was a very popular underdog babyface in Evolve. Has a lot of fans. A lot of people like Leon Ruff. So I know people were happy to hear that he was signed. This was his formal debut on NXT, and it was Johnny Gargano just, you know, kind of rigging the wheel to get an easy opponent. Damian Priest was out there at ringside watching the whole thing and, you know, kind of sort of distracting. Johnny was a little distracted. And it ended with Leon Ruff rolling up Johnny Gargano with a crucifix, and he wins the North American Championship. Match only went 3 or 4 minutes. I guess this is supposed to be their, like, modern-day version of Horowitz wins, when Barry Horowitz pinned Skip of the Body Donnas, or the 1-2-3 Kid pinned Razor Ramon. So he is now the new North American champion. Leon Ruff, all 120 pounds looking of him, is the new North American champion. Damian Priest was celebrating with him after the match. He had the belt wrapped around his waist, and as soon as Leon put his hands up to pose, the belt fell down to the floor. Doesn't even fit him. The belt looks bigger than he does. And Gargano was beside himself. He couldn't believe it. Now, part of the story here is that Johnny Gargano, he's like the Sasha Banks of NXT. He has a reputation for winning a championship and then not being able to defend it. He loses it in his first defense. It happened the first time with the North American title. It happened the first time when he won the NXT title. And he was determined, which is why he picked Ruff. He was determined to, kill the curse or reverse the jinx. And that did not happen. First defense, and there it is again. He loses the championship. This is his gimmick now. He wins it, but he can't hold on to it. And I was not expecting this. This came out of left field. I liked it. This was more about furthering the Gargano Priest feud than it was trying to make a new star in Leon Ruff. That is not, I think, what this segment was designed to do. I don't expect him to even hold on to it for longer than a week, maybe a few weeks at the most. But this is more about furthering the feud between Gargano and Priest. But I enjoyed it. It was something out of the ordinary. You know, again, they're furthering that issue there. If Leon Ruff gets a little bit of a rub out of it, great. But it doesn't strike me as being something that was done to help him as much as it was done really to help Johnny and Damian Priest. Santos Escobar, he beat Jake Atlas for the Cruiserweight Championship. You knew you weren't going to see back-to-back title changes, so that took a little bit of the drama out of it. They had a good match. It's a pretty good match. Escobar won pretty much clean after his boys got ejected by the referee. So he continues his run as the champion. Raquel Gonzalez was supposed to wrestle Xia Li. Xia Li was not there. We know that because Boa came out and said that she's not here. And that didn't please Raquel. She beat the piss out of Boa. Gave him a power bomb. She wrecked this dude. And then poor Boa. He's laying there. The lights go out. There's an image of a Chinese dragon on the screen that appears, and a man walks out. This older-looking Asian gentleman walks out, looking like Shang Tsung from the Mortal Kombat game. He comes walking out, and he delivers a note to Boa. And he puts a black marking on Boa's hand, and then he turns around and he walks away. So I have no idea what this is about. I have no idea what's going on here. I've been intrigued by the whole, you know, Xia Li getting these notes with these Chinese characters on them, and we don't know what's in the note, but she's like, oh God, you know, Mr. Regal, please, you got to give me a match. I need a match. I need to win. I don't know what is so important that she has to win matches, you know, on NXT, you know, here at the COVID Coliseum, but I don't know where the story is going. I guess I'm intrigued because I don't know. I don't know who this man was. I don't know where he fits in. I don't know if he can teleport from one spot to the other, like in the game, but we'll see. But I have absolutely no clue what is going on here. I have no clue. And you know what? Sometimes that's okay to not have any clue. They keep you on your toes. They keep you wondering what's going to be next. Candice LeRae beat Toni Storm. We finally got the big reveal of who was under the ghost face mask. And in fact, surprise, surprise, it was, in fact, Indy Hartwell. So Indy Hartwell was ghost face. She is aligned with Candice LeRae. Timothy Thatcher got a win over Dexter Lumis when Cameron Grimes got involved. Cameron Grimes is no longer afraid of Dexter Lumis. He cost Dexter Lumis the match. He put a burlap sack over his head. He gave him the cave-in, left him laying. So that issue is going to continue. And then in the main event, Danny Burch and Oney Lorcan, they beat Breezango to retain their tag team titles. Pat McAfee came out with the boys, cut a promo before the match. Pat McAfee, he was born for this. He really does. He was born for this role. He's so great in this role. And he did commentary for the match. And they retained their titles, even though Drake Maverick tried to get involved. And, you know, he's obviously upset about what happened to Killian Dane. They left Killian Dane in a pool of blood outside the building the week before. Even his interference, though, did not help. So the heels kept their titles. It was this just mass chaos when the match was over. Bodies everywhere. The heels were left standing. Pat McAfee grabbed the camera. He cut a promo into the camera, did his little catchphrase at the end, and that was the show. So his group, do they have a name? I don't know if they have a name yet. But he did refer to them as the best four-man group in professional wrestling or professional wrestling history. I don't know if they've given them a name and I just missed it, but I'm enjoying the act. You know, Pete Dunne's out there. He's looking, like I said, Pete Dunne. I don't know what Finn Balor is going to announce on TV this week. I hope they don't strip him of the belt, but we got to get to a Finn Balor. I mean, we got to get to a Finn Balor-Walter match at some point, but we got to get to Finn Balor and Pete Dunne for the NXT Championship. That's the match I want to see. Future NXT Champion Pete Dunne, I could see it. I could buy that.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, 23 years ago this week, we begin on November 9th, 1997. The most infamous match in WWE history took place, the Montreal Screwjob. I always get roped into talking about, every time I say, that's the last time I'm going to talk about the Montreal Screwjob, it ends up coming right back up again. Although, in part, I wanted to mention it anyway this week for another reason. I'm going to tell you why in a second. But this was at Survivor Series 1997. You all know what happened. Bret Hart did not like Shawn Michaels. Shawn Michaels did not like Bret Hart. But Bret Hart went to Shawn Michaels a few months before the show and said, look, I'm willing to do business. And Shawn Michaels told Bret, and this is according to Bret, told Bret, well, I appreciate that, but I just want you to know I'm not willing to do the same for you. And that one comment set the stage for what happened in Montreal, which really killed Bret's career. I mean, he had a few fun moments in WCW, you know, wearing the giant metal plate when Goldberg gave him a spear, the El Dandy promo. Those are like the only two things from WCW I really think back and smile on when I think of Bret Hart. That and the Benoit match, but that was kind of somber because it was a tribute match to Owen. But basically his career was over. He just didn't realize it. When he got screwed in Montreal, that was it. He never really attained that same level of stardom. Even with all the championships he held in WCW, it just never felt the same. but it did set the company up for the biggest boom period in its existence up to that point, with the Mr. McMahon character playing the foil to Stone Cold during the Attitude Era. This is what really helped set the stage for that to happen. Now, a year before this, Brett passed up a three-year deal, a three-year $9 million offer from WCW to sign a 20-year contract to stay with WWE. And one of the provisions that he negotiated into that contract was that he would have creative control over his character in his final 60 days, not 30, 60 days, should he leave WWE for any reason. I mean, look, it's a 20-year contract. He's not planning on going anywhere. But as we saw, shit happens. And if shit happens, you want to have a fail-safe. They were throwing everything they could at him to make him happy and keep him from leaving and going to WCW. And he was like, look, I'm going to put this provision in the contract to protect myself and to ensure that I'm not going to be made to look bad or be buried or anything like that on my way out should I have to leave for any reason. Can't blame the guy for trying. It's like all the people who love to sling mud at Hulk Hogan because in lawsuits and whatever, it's leaked over the years copies of his old contract with WCW from like 98 or something. And it's unbelievable the contract that this guy had, the cut that he was getting from the pay-per-views, and just, it was unbelievable. And of course, Hogan always had 100% full creative control. And people would like to kind of take pot shots at him, but you know what? If you're Hulk Hogan, and you think you can get a deal like that from WCW, it's not Hogan's fault. Blame Eric Bischoff and WCW and Ted Turner for giving him the deal in the first place. If I thought I could negotiate a contract and have creative control, hell, why not? So Brett took his shot. Vince went against his better judgment and did for Brett what he did for no one else. And little did he know that it would come back to become a real headache for him only a year later. But this whole creative control issue is a fact that is clearly lost on this Robin Lundberg, I have to talk about this. This is a perfect place to bring this up. Robin Lundberg is the name of the author of this awful column for Sports Illustrated that went up on their website earlier this week, titled "Brett Screwed Brett Unchecked." That was the title of the article. I get that Sports Illustrated, the magazine, and Sports Illustrated Online are two different beasts, okay? They're two different, almost like two different entities in a way. I think their wrestling coverage is reserved exclusively for the website. I don't believe it, I don't think it appears in the actual publication. But it's on the website because they know it gets clicks. It gets them traffic. Although maybe not anymore after this piece was published. But someone linked me to this, and they wanted my thoughts. So I read it, which did not take me very long because the article was maybe four paragraphs long. I had no idea who this Robin Lundberg person even was. I looked him up. Apparently, he also does stuff for CBS Sports and for Sirius XM. It's just embarrassing. I'm not going to read the entire thing to you, which I could do. It would take me all of 2.5 minutes to read the full article. But the crux of it is the best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be, and a big baby. And then this part. Hart was leaving the company. At that point, should he really get to dictate the terms? Imagine if this happened in professional sports rather than professional wrestling. Let a star player refuse to enter a game or run a play and then wait for the takes. Actually, yes, he can dictate those terms. You know why he can dictate those terms? Because of Vince McMahon. Because Vince McMahon allowed it to be inserted into his contract. That is a pretty important piece of information to leave out, which he will now claim that, oh, I knew about that. But yeah, you can't do a column like that for Sports Illustrated and mention this and not mention the fact that, oh yeah, you know what? The guy actually, he did have the right, if he wanted to exercise this little clause in his contract, which is kind of important. It's kind of an important detail to leave out. Now I see they posted an update. This guy got so much heat, I don't think I've ever seen this before. he got so much heat for this dreck, this awful, just garbage article. Poorly written, poorly thought out. It's like a blog post. I still don't know what it's doing on the Sports Illustrated website. But they got so much heat for it that they had Justin Barrasso, who writes for Sports Illustrated, they had him record a video with this Robin guy. A video update to the written piece to allow for him to better explain himself. And even Barrasso called him out for his dumb take, which he was sticking to his guns. He was doubling down on his stupidity. But he got called out. Even Barrasso called him out. And having now watched the video, as I did earlier, because I saw there was an update, I said, I guess if I'm going to talk about this, I'd better watch the update and see what this guy has to say for himself. Having now watched the video and watched this guy kind of twist and try to defend himself, he somehow manages to come across even worse, having watched the video. But you see, this is why they cover wrestling. Look at the reaction that it generated. How much traffic do you think that article probably got? How many tweets about the article or linking to the article did they probably get? More than they've ever gotten before. And now they're trying to give this guy a chance to save face. The fans didn't screw Sports Illustrated. Sports Illustrated screwed Sports Illustrated by putting this garbage up on their website. 22 years ago this week, on November 15th, 1998, WWE hosted a one-night-only deadly game tournament at Survivor Series to crown a new WWE champion. This was the first Survivor Series in history without any traditional Survivor Series elimination matches on the show. Even the 1992 card had one. This had none. Instead, it was a 14-match card, not counting the matches on Heat, because they decided to do a 14-man elimination tournament in one night. Now look, I miss the old King of the Ring format where they did the entire tournament in one night, but that was different. That was an 8-man tournament. You had the first round, semis, and the finals. And the first one with Bret Hart, you know, beating Razor and then beating Mr. Perfect and then beating Bam Bam Bigelow, three completely different opponents. It was such a great show. And it was, what was it? I guess Bigelow got a bye. I think Bigelow got a bye because Luger and Tatanka went to a draw. So it was only, I think, 7 matches. But that's very different than having a 14-man or a 16-man tournament. This was 14 because Undertaker and Kane got a bye right into the quarterfinals. That's very different. That's a lot of matches, and it's a lot of short, crappy matches, which is really what this tournament was filled with. This tournament was filled with short, crappy matches that really aren't very good. You go back and watch this tournament, it really was not very good. But the Russo swerves, I will say, they were pretty good. Shane McMahon turned heel. He cost Stone Cold his semifinal match against Mankind. Austin made the mistake of trusting a McMahon, and it backfired. Vince McMahon, who had just presented Mankind with the new hardcore title a few weeks earlier, was buttering up Mick Foley. He was buttering him up. He even at one point said, "You know what, Mick, you're like a son to me." And it was all leading to him taking the fall to The Rock here in the finals. The corporate swerve. They recreated the Montreal Screwjob finish from the year before, which I thought was stupid. But they had Rock beat Mankind. He won his very first WWE World Championship. The title match on Raw the next night between Austin and The Rock, that thing was just straight fire. I mean, that thing, my God, that crowd was just, could not possibly have been any more amped up for that match than they were. But to go back and they didn't get the title change that night, but to go back and watch that Raw main event the next night, if you do, and I encourage you to go ahead and do so. The moment that Austin steps into the ring, like he marches down to the ring, he steps through the rope, The Rock immediately comes after him. I mean, there's no silliness, there's no cut. I mean, let's cut to a commercial break. They do that all the time now, right? 30 seconds into a match, let's go to a commercial. There's no commercial cut. There's no bullshit from the announcers. There's no hashtags to promote. There's no award-winning Thunderdome. Just two guys doing battle. and people losing their minds. That is pro wrestling at its finest. And pro wrestling at its worst, on the same episode, with Road Warrior Hawk threatening to jump to his death from the top of the Titantron and then being shoved off by Draz. That happened the same night. You had, hey, for all the great stuff on the shows back then, there was some god-awful stuff. And that was among the worst, just, you know, crappiest, most tasteless things they've ever done. That whole storyline, playing off of Hawk's real-life alcohol problems, that whole thing was tasteless. 21 years ago, at the SmackDown taping on November 9th, 1999, airing 2 days later, Arnold Schwarzenegger made a very memorable appearance to promote his new movie, The End of Days. Remember that? I remember that promo, The End of Days. I watched The End of Days. It was all right. It was okay. Vince McMahon presented him with a replica Big Eagle WWE belt, and he provided commentary for the main event, which saw The Rock, Shane McMahon, Kane, and Test defeat Triple H, X-Pac, and the New Age Outlaws in an elimination match. Stone Cold Steve Austin, he was the guest enforcer. He hit Triple H in the head with a chair to give Test the victory. Arnold was the one who handed that chair to Stone Cold. After the match, Triple H took a swing at Arnold over at the announce desk. Arnold, he ducked out of the way, and he proceeded to deck Triple H and beat the crap out of him. And then he drank beer in the ring with Austin. Arnold looked like he was having the time of his life out there. On that same episode of SmackDown came one of the more memorable segments in SmackDown history. And you are correct if you are of the belief that this also was very tasteless and you didn't really like it. I have to say, having watched it played out, this whole feud between the Big Show and the Big Boss Man is a guilty pleasure of mine. And it's all because of the Big Boss Man. This was in the middle of the feud between these two. The Boss Man was mocking Big Show at every turn after his father, in storyline, died of cancer. In real life, his father did die of cancer when he was younger. But this whole thing supposedly was Big Show's idea. Russo was all, I mean, people can blame him if they want to, but you'd be an idiot because Russo was already gone. He wasn't even working there anymore. So you can't just chalk this up to another Russo storyline. He was already in WCW. But Boss Man did some horrible things to this man during that program. He went to his mother's house. He got Big Show's mother to admit on I mean, she didn't realize that she was being recorded at the time, but they're filming this in her kitchen through a window. There's like a hidden camera. And he got Boss Man's mother on TV to admit that her son was a bastard child. The poem. Who can forget the infamous poem? With the deepest regrets and tears that are soaked, I'm sorry to hear your dad finally croaked. He lived a full life on his own terms. Soon he'll be buried and eaten by worms. But if I could have a son as stupid as you, I'd have wished for cancer so I would die too. My God. My God. My God. And then there was the funeral for the Big Show's father, which took place in a real cemetery. Bruce Pritchard tells the story. This company is something else. Filming shit like this in a cemetery, filming shit in a funeral home with an actual wake going on in the room right next to them. Somebody in a casket screwing the brains out of a mannequin. This company is just the picture of class. It blows my mind that Vince McMahon was so upset and couldn't figure out for years why he couldn't get classier sponsors like car companies to advertise on his shows. I can't figure out why. I'm scratching my head here trying to figure out why. Why some of these Buick and Honda and all these companies wouldn't want to advertise with such a classy organization. But this was filmed in a real cemetery, and Pritchard tells the story that the groundskeeper told them before they started filming, look, we have a service in the next couple of hours. If you guys can get this done before then, that would be great. And please, please, please do not damage any of the grounds. So they have this mock service, this mock funeral, which is interrupted by the Big Boss Man. Big Boss Man comes driving in this old Blues Brothers looking cop car, which has a giant loudspeaker on the roof. So his voice is coming through on the loudspeaker. He's shouting things. They're in the middle of this cemetery. They're right in the middle. And so you've got real people coming in to pay their respects to their loved ones. And they hear this guy on this giant loudspeaker hurling insults at the Big Show. Boss Man says to Big Show's mother, you know, you're a widow now. Maybe you want to be with a real man. And at that point, the Big Show comes charging over at Boss Man, who quickly gets back in the car. Big Show kind of steps onto the hood, and the Boss Man starts to drive. Big Show takes a bump on the floor. So everybody goes over to crowd around Big Show and make sure he's not dead, make sure he's okay. Boss Man, meanwhile, he drives over near the casket. He gets out of the car. He has a giant chain, and he loops the chain around the handle of the casket, ties it to the back of the car, and he's still shouting insults. And he gets back in the car, and he begins to drive off with the casket tied to the back of this car. And the Big Show sees this. He runs over. He dives on top of the casket with his father inside. He's body surfing this casket. And the whole time, this is tearing up the grounds. I mean, this is tearing up the dirt. Big Show's on top of the casket. And he body surfed it, I'd say, for maybe a few yards before sliding off. And he took this great, exaggerated, upside-down bump. Like, literally, you remember in the Survivor Series match in 96 with Shawn Michaels and Sid? It's like a meme. If you do a Google image search, you'll find the picture. Shawn took a bump at one point. I don't remember what the bump was, but he took a bump and there's this great still photo of him literally standing on his head. He's standing on his head. That's basically what the Big Show did here. He was on his head for a little bit, then he flipped over and landed face down in the dirt. And off went the Big Boss Man, you know, driving off with the Big Show's dead daddy in the casket. Pritchard actually called that the worst bump in the history of the business. And I really think they didn't like it. Vince McMahon didn't like it because when I was watching the video package, I had to go back and watch the video package to the build for their match at Armageddon, which was horrible. That match was terrible. But I'm watching the video package and they cut that out. They cut the bump out when the Big Show went sliding off. And I'm like, how do you cut that out? That was the best part of the whole thing. What are you talking about? What do you mean worst bump? That was the best part of the whole damn segment. And they cut it out. They don't even show it in the build to the match. But they got a call the next day, Pritchard did, telling them that they would never again be allowed to use that cemetery. I can't imagine why. A few days later, on November 14, 1999, we had Survivor Series featuring the in-ring debut of a certain Olympic gold medalist named Kurt Angle against Meat, the name Sean Stasiak was going by at the time. Not that Kurt Angle was a vegan or anything like that. It was a man called Meat. WCW had a man called Sting. WWE had a man called Meat. From his very first match, Angle was just a total natural. I mean, he picked things up faster than anybody I've ever seen. Only Brock Lesnar and Ronda Rousey, I think, really even come close. This guy just picked it up on day one. The main event was originally scheduled to be a triple threat match with Triple H defending the WWF title against Stone Cold and The Rock. Kind of hard to believe we never got that match. I don't think ever. I don't think we ever had a triple threat with those three. That would have been a big main event. And it didn't happen because Austin's neck could take no more. And WWE pulled the old bait and switch. They shot an angle where Austin got mowed down in the parking garage by a car while he was looking for Triple H. A year later, we would find out that Rikishi did it for The Rock. But really, he did it for Triple H. This was a very scummy move because the company knew, they knew in advance, at least a few days, maybe longer, but at least a few days in advance, they knew that Austin was, based on the results, you know, of the test on his neck and everything, that he was not going to be able to or cleared to compete at the pay-per-view. They knew this. This was not something they found out the day before. This was not something they found out the day of. They knew that one third of their big main event and the biggest star in the company, the biggest pay-per-view attraction they had, would not be able to wrestle on the pay-per-view. And they knew this and they said nothing and they waited. They waited until people had already bought the pay-per-view before they pulled this bait and switch and they shot that angle. And that's a really scummy thing for them to do. Because if you know that the guy is not going to be able to wrestle on the show, then you have an obligation to let your audience know that, look, Stone, now whether you just want to be honest or if you want to shoot the angle and show that, you know, earlier on the syndicated shows or if they knew far enough in advance, they could have done something on Raw, you know, 6 days earlier. I don't know exactly which day they found out, but they knew. They knew. And they didn't tell people. So you had a lot of disappointed people who were expecting Austin to wrestle and then he didn't. But they already had your money, so they don't care because they already got your money. So piss off. But I guess they did the title change here. Big Show won the championship. Big Show was the replacement for Stone Cold. They had to give something to the fans as a make good, so they had Big Show win the belt. They did the title change. Maybe they thought it would play off the sympathy of Big Show in storyline, having just lost his dad. And they actually, in their mind, maybe thought that this would work. It didn't. You want to give the fans a make good? How about not scamming them into thinking that they're getting one match and then giving them another? That's one way you can make good with your audience. 15 years ago this week, on November 13th, 2005, we lost one of the greats. At the age of 38, when Eddie Guerrero was found dead in his hotel room in Minneapolis, the same day he was due to wrestle Randy Orton and Batista for the World Heavyweight title at a SmackDown taping, a rare Sunday SmackDown taping. I think they may have been going on an international tour, and that's why they were taping SmackDown on Sunday, I believe. I believe that's the case. His nephew Chavo made the discovery. He was supposed to meet up with his uncle that morning, and something was obviously wrong. He didn't answer his early morning wake-up call. They got him into the room. He found Eddie on the bathroom floor with a toothbrush in his hand, barely alive, and he passed away in Chavo's arms. He was still alive. His heart was still beating when Chavo found him. He talked about this on Dark Side of the Ring, and he died in his arms. He died from heart failure. The medical examiner found the blood vessels in his heart had narrowed greatly, and when that happens, what it does is it forces your heart to work that much harder and to pump blood that much harder, and it's just not a good outcome when that happens. Contrary to popular belief, Eddie Guerrero was not scheduled to win the world title that night at the SmackDown taping. That was going to be Randy Orton. Randy Orton was going to be the one to beat Batista. Although he may have pinned Eddie in the match, but he was going to win the championship that night. Batista confirmed this in his book. He said that he wanted Eddie to win the title. Not only did he want Eddie to win the title, he and Eddie were tight. He was going to try to convince Vince McMahon. He was going to make his big pitch to Vince, and he told Eddie this. I'm going to go to Vince, and I'm going to argue that you should be the one to win the championship. Eddie called Batista, though, late at night, the night before he died, or early morning before he passed away, like in the middle of the night, 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, something like that. Batista was already sleeping, so he missed the call. Eddie left him a voicemail. And that's the last message that Dave ever got from him. And it was a message basically saying, look, don't do it. Don't go to Vince. Don't talk to Vince. Randy should win. Randy should be the champion, not me. Trust in Vince. He's smart. He does business. He knows what he's doing. Randy should win. And that was the last message that Batista ever got from him. Eddie was one of the good ones. His death, I mean, all of these deaths are terrible. All these young wrestler deaths are just horrible. But some, I think, hit harder than others. For me, Owen's death was the worst. Just the way that all went down and happening in front of 20,000 people on a pay-per-view, and it just never should have happened. The Benoit stuff still haunts. I mean, that was the biggest wrestling tragedy of all time. was the Benoit stuff. Three people lost their lives, including a child. It doesn't get any worse than that. That still haunts me to this day whenever I spend too much time thinking about it. And I remember where I was when I found out the news. It was just horrible. But Benoit was never the same after Eddie died. The people who knew him said as much. It changed him. He lost his best friend. Benoit's wife bought him a journal so that he could write to Eddie. Just let his thoughts out. He filled that journal up. I think they found it after he died. So that hit him. I mean, it was a soul-crushing loss. It hit him harder. It almost, you watch that Dark Side of the Ring special, and it almost feels like it hit him harder than it hit Eddie's family, which I'm sure it didn't, but maybe it did. It was soul-crushing for him. But I will always remember, as far as Eddie Guerrero, the match with Brock Lesnar at No Way Out in 2004, when he won that WWE Championship and him jumping into the crowd and celebrating and just his family, his mom was there. The picture in the back of him hugging Vince McMahon and hugging the title. He was so happy. And it was just such a great moment. And one of the all-time great WWE pay-per-view moments was Eddie Guerrero winning the championship that night. If there's one good thing that came out of Eddie's death, it was the genesis of the WWE wellness policy, which came only a few months later. It was February. He died in November of 2005. In February of 2006, WWE unveiled their new talent wellness policy. Now, I think at the time, WWE claimed, well, it's not because of Eddie. We were already working on this. It was already in the works. I don't buy that. But it came about after Eddie died, because his death just hit differently. It just did. It hit differently. The policy, though, had more holes in it than Swiss cheese. I mean, after it was first unveiled, there were a lot of loopholes in there. You could drive a truck through some of them. After the Benoit tragedy, that's where they really started to, I don't want to say take it seriously, but that's really where they started to kind of shore up the policy. And today, it's a pretty robust policy. Is it a perfect policy? No. Can people get around it? I'm sure they do. But they have a pretty robust policy in place today. Now it's 15 years later. I'm not so sure that policy would be either in existence or that it would be as good as it is were it not for what happened, 15 years ago. So if there, that's part of his legacy. It was an unfortunate consequence of it. But that's why I say if there's one positive that came out of it, it is that wellness policy. And 1 year ago this week, in the early morning hours of November 9th, 2019, pro wrestling lost one of its rising young independent stars in 25-year-old Matt Travis, who became the 8th cyclist to die riding his bike in New York City last year. 28th. Did I say 8th? 28th. The 28th cyclist last year to lose their life in New York City when he was struck by a dump truck driver making an illegal left turn. And the driver's punishment, we found out about this a few months ago. The driver's punishment, he had his driver's license revoked for 6 months and he had to pay a $250 fine. That was the second dump truck driver to work for that same trucking company who struck and killed somebody last year alone. It's ridiculous. But Matt was very talented. I had the pleasure of being able to call some of his matches in House of Glory. And it was very cool of Santana and Ortiz to dedicate their match to him at the AEW pay-per-view later that night, and for Excalibur to acknowledge, Matt Travis on TV. Later that night, AEW did host its first Full Gear pay-per-view, which featured MJF throwing in the towel for Cody in Cody's championship match against Chris Jericho, which rendered Cody, as per the stipulation, unable to ever again challenge for the AEW title. After the match, MJF kicked Cody in the balls, and Jon Moxley beat Kenny Omega in a non-sanctioned lights-out match. Now here we are 1 year later, and Omega will challenge Moxley for the AEW title on December 2nd. and it feels like the right time for him to get that win back. And that is this week in wrestling history. We'll do a couple of quick mailbag questions here. I did 90 of them the other day. We'll do a couple more here. You can always email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. It will help your chances of getting your question asked and answered on the air. And if I don't get to them on the air, I might respond directly. If I don't respond directly, you never know. It might be on the next video inbox. I guess you'll just have to tune in to find out. But that is the email address. Start here with Dylan from Toronto. Do you see Pac as a future AEW world champion? If we follow your booking idea and Hangman Page eventually takes the title from Kenny Omega, maybe Pac then takes it off of Hangman. You talk about certain people as being the future of AEW, but where does Pac fit into all of that? I think he fits in there just as much as anybody else does. A lot of it, I think, will depend on the travel situation. The fact that he's back, obviously he was able to come here, but I don't know where he's, you know, does he still take up residence there? Does he want to go back home? I don't know what his plans are. It depends on that, number one. But number two, yeah, absolutely. I think Pac is a big part, or should be a big part, of the future plans in AEW. Do I see him, or can I see him one day as being the AEW World Champion? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Without a doubt. Now, he's got that character down to a science, man. He comes out there and he's pissed off of the world. And yeah, he may not physically be the biggest guy in the world, but he's ripped to shreds and he can go in there and hang with just about anybody, no matter how big or small they are. He's a great wrestler. He's great at what he does. So as far as I'm concerned, he could be as much a world champion as anybody else in that company. He's in a position right now where he's more, I think, in a position where he's more well-prepared to be the champion than some of the guys who I eventually see maybe holding on to that title, like a Darby Allin or somebody like that. Pac is ready right now. I just don't know that that fits into the story, though. I think it should go to Omega, from Omega then to Hangman. And that, I'm talking like long-term. I'm planning this out like a year out. So I don't think there's any world title in Pac's future in the near term. But yeah, absolutely, I could see him as being the champion, and I would have nothing against it. I'm not going to hold his size against him. Absolutely, he could be a world champion. And Loose Cannon Lopez, my good buddy John Loose Cannon Lopez, he sent in a question. Also wishing a happy 13-year anniversary for the podcast. He says the first full episode of the Sound Off that he ever listened to was episode 241 in 2012. He also says Sound Off 343 is his favorite of all the episodes. That was my Sound Off the Wagon special. We did that one from Webmaster Mike's place. I remember that. We did that a few weeks before WrestleMania 31. I think we did WrestleMania 31 predictions on that show. That was a lot of fun to do. We had a full house for that show. Mike was there, Noah, Brian, our buddy Jared, Amanda. We had a female voice on that show as well. I look forward to the day that we can record a Sound Off the Wagon Part 2. I look forward to that day. I look forward to the day that all this bullshit is over and is in the rearview mirror and we can do a Part 2. I think that would be a lot of fun. But John has a spinoff of the buy or sell segment for me. He's calling it Keep, Borrow, Cherish, and Sell on the best WWE pay-per-view show from Madison Square Garden of these four choices: SummerSlam 1991, WrestleMania 10, Survivor Series 1996, and Royal Rumble 2000. So leaving Survivor Series 2002 off this list. That's going to piss some people off. So he says it's keep, borrow, cherish, and sell. Shouldn't it be keep and then cherish? And then borrow and then sell? We're going to do it that way. I think that's how we'll do this. I like Survivor Series 96. Okay, it's one of those rare shows that I don't think I liked it as much the first time I saw it as I do now. You know, sometimes you hear like, oh, that didn't age well. Like, I really liked it, but now I go back and I watch it and it's not as good. This is like the inverse. where I remember not really being all that enamored with this pay-per-view when I watched it live in 96. But as I've gone back and I've watched it more recently, I think I've gained a newfound appreciation for it. I think I like it more now, you know, than I did 24 years ago, the first time I saw it. And really, it's entirely for two matches. The first meeting between, and I know The Rock made his debut on that show, but it's really for two matches. The first meeting between Bret Hart and Steve Austin, which was excellent, and the main event with Psycho Sid winning the WWF Championship from Shawn Michaels. That was the best match of Sid's career. Find me a better Sid match. I don't think he ever had a better match than he had with Shawn Michaels in the Garden that night. And the crowd definitely played a part in that. You know, it was just a, it was like a big fight atmosphere. People loved Sid. When Sid came back in the summer of 96, I don't know what it was, because he had already been with the company two other times. Now, maybe it was just the fact that it was, he was a heel both of those times, and now he was a babyface. But man, this guy was just, he was over like gangbusters when he came back in 96, when the Warrior got fired, they brought Sid in. And, you know, it was going to be Shawn and Vader at Survivor Series, and then that plan went away, and it was Sid who took his place. And he got over. And the people in the Garden that night, they hated Shawn Michaels, but they loved Psycho Sid. Even though Psycho Sid, he tried to kill an old man, he hit Jose Lothario in the chest with a TV camera, and they were portraying it like he was having a heart attack. The crowd didn't seem to care. New Yorkers did not seem to give a damn about poor Jose Lothario writhing on the ground, dying. But they loved the fact that Sid won the championship. But of the choices you've given me, I have to sell. You got to make sacrifices here. I got to sell on this one. SummerSlam 1991 is one of my favorite SummerSlams ever. The match made in heaven, the match made in hell. I love how Bobby Heenan confused the two and he thought the wedding was the match made in hell. Bret Hart winning the Intercontinental title from Mr. Perfect is a classic, and that's not even the best of the pay-per-view matches that they had. I thought their match at the King of the Ring in 93 was better. But that, it's just a classic match. The place popped huge for Virgil winning the $1 million title from Ted DiBiase. I loved the jailhouse stuff with the Mountie and the Big Boss Man and those segments. I loved it. I remember that as a kid. I watch them back now. They're every bit as entertaining now. When he loses the match and they have to cuff him and take him down to the pokey. Oh, that's great. And also, LOD beat the Nasty Boys to win the tag team titles on that show. It wasn't much of a match, but it was history. It was a historic moment, seeing them win the championships for the first time. I've got to just borrow, though. I've got to borrow on this one, because these next two are the two best Garden pay-per-views that this company has ever done. I'm going to cherish the 2000 Royal Rumble. I've always loved the look of that show with the giant taxi cab above the little short, you know, the short entranceway, which sadly is no longer there. The Taz debut opening the show against Kurt Angle was masterful, which was the exact opposite of how they handled the rest of his run. The tables match with the Hardys and the Dudleys is a forgotten gem. The Rumble match, even the Royal Rumble match itself, I thought was good. But what really makes this show is the street fight for the championship between Triple H and Cactus Jack. It was the match, for me anyway, it was the match that made Triple H. It made me buy into Triple H as a believable main event level performer. Not the match with Vince McMahon, not the matches he had with Stone Cold in the fall. It was this. It was this street fight that really sold me on Triple H in that spot. So I love that show. But I will cherish that one. I will keep the best pay-per-view, WWE pay-per-view in Madison Square Garden history, which is WrestleMania 10. And it was entirely a two-match show. The greatest, but see, the thing is, though, you could say, like, wasn't there more to like about the Rumble in 2000 or, again, even Survivor Series 02, which wasn't on this list. Some people might say SummerSlam 98, which I think is overrated. What does everybody think of when they think of SummerSlam 98? What's the first thing they think of? They think of the ladder match between Triple H and The Rock. Right, because that's really the only great thing about that show. Austin and Undertaker, that wasn't a great match. I didn't think it was a great match. I've had better. Jeff Jarrett got a haircut, right, when he lost to X-Pac. What else is so memorable about that show? But WrestleMania 10, the two big matches, I mean, these are two of the best matches in company history. You can't find, I mean, two matches like this on the same show, how does this not end up in the number one spot? The greatest opener in WrestleMania history with the brothers facing off, right? Bret versus Owen. And the ladder match between Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon. So that one I would keep. So I hope that answers your question. A little bit of a different take on the buy or sell this week. I am thinking about doing Survivor Series predictions on Thursday. If I do, I'll probably go live on YouTube Thursday night. I'll see. This card, man, I'm not impressed with this card. There's still holes in the card. I'll make a decision later this week. If I do my predictions before Sunday, that's when it would be. It would be on YouTube live Thursday night. I will keep you guys posted on that on Twitter, at Solomonster. By the time I do the Dynamite stream on Wednesday, I'll let you guys know. I'll know by then if I'm going live the night after. And if I do, I hope you'll join me, like you did for the Sound Off Inbox. We had a good time. By the way, my bottle of bubbly, the Chris Jericho bubbly that I opened up and I was drinking a little bit of on that stream, I still have it. I don't have one of those, because I'm not like a wine drinker, so I don't have one of those, like, stoppers, the cork stoppers or whatever to put back in the bottle. So the bottle's been open in the fridge. Amazingly, I checked it last night. It still has fizz. It still tastes the same. It still has fizz. It's been open, just sitting in the fridge now for 3 days. But yeah, I don't think it's going to last much longer. But I thought it was good. It's my first time trying the Jericho bubbly. It's like any other champagne I've ever tasted before. That's my review. It served its purpose. It was a celebratory occasion. I had gotten that as a gift. And I figure, why not? Why not? There's no better time, right? There's no better time to open it than on Thursday night. But thank you for everybody who joined me. Please go back and watch that video. Again, your question may be in there if it hasn't been answered and you may not even know it. So go back and check out that video. It's up on the YouTube channel, all 2 hours and 45 minutes of it. I will be back with you for the Dynamite stream on Wednesday. Next Sunday is Survivor Series Sunday. That is episode 679 of this podcast. Thank you for supporting me through the first 678. And I hope you will join me again and keep supporting next week. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week, and join me for more Sound Off next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
It was time for the big steak dinner between Chris Jericho and MJF. And MJF orders himself a 20-ounce porterhouse. Well done. Chris Jericho says, I'll have my steak medium well. MJF changes his to medium. Let me interject here. Everybody knows that the correct way to eat your steak, medium well. And if you want to have ketchup with your steak, there's nothing wrong with that either. A nice medium well steak with some ketchup. There you go.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter, at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.